This is Kelly Crager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. James Cohn. Today is 24 July 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech University. And Mr. Cohn is joining us from his home in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Good morning, Mr. Cohn.
Good morning.
We're very pleased that you are taking time out of your day today to speak with us here at the Vietnam Archive. To begin with, let's start with a little biographical information. When were you born and where?
Born July 15, 1942, San Antonio, Texas.
So you're a native Texan then?
2 months later, I was got out to Tucson and then spent Tucson, Arizona.
I'm sorry, can you hear me? Okay, okay. What were your parents' names?
My mother was Mary Ruth Hale. Mother was Marshall.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a wholesale tobacco distributor, and my mother was a housewife.
Okay. How would you describe your childhood?
Describe it as have television until I was 11. Stayed outside a lot and walking around the neighborhood with a BB gun, and nobody said anything. And, you know, it was different back then.
Sure. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I had a half brother and a half sister.
And what are their names?
Patricia Spencer Cohn.
All right. What was school like for you?
School life, yes. I was very, very happy in school. I'd say I was the captain of the school patrol in elementary school, and school I played a lot of sports, football, baseball, basketball, ran track, and continued in high school into sports and athletics.
What about academics? What were your favorite subjects there?
More interested in sports. But I was an average student.
Sure, sure. Okay. Well, when did you make up your mind to join the military?
Probably at an early age. When we had in our family, I had a great uncle who served with the Marines in France in World War I. Stepbrother who was with the Marines in the Pacific in World War II. Seed was kind of planted early that if I was ever going in the military, I would join the Marines.
Why the Marine Corps?
Well, which detail do you want?
Anything that you want to add?
I can tell you how the watch works. You just tell me how much detail.
Well, anything that you want to that you think is important to add here. It was a very, very big decision for you.
I was with some guys, and one of them threw a cherry bomb out of the car, and it went off under a police car. It's over to the campus police, and the dean of men had me on probation. Then my junior year, to a call with a rival fraternity, some rival fraternity members at a local. So was charged with public intoxication. Dean of men said, well, you are already on probation, so now you're suspended for a semester. This is the University of Arizona. And I came back to school thinking I need to redeem myself somehow. So started Eddie Brothers had gone through the Marine Corps Platoon Leaders Corps. So impressed with them when they came back after their summer training. I did. So when I graduated from college, I was on the 5-year plan, Vietnam. Candidate school. have a misdemeanor or arrest record. They needed officer material, mm-hmm. and they kind of signed it on, gave me a waiver, and said, go for it.
Interesting. Now, what were you studying here at the University of Arizona?
The law enforcement government major.
Okay, okay. And it was going to be the Marine Corps then. Now, attending the University of Arizona and having this inclination toward the military and toward the Marine Corps, how aware were you of the United States and the world, its policies, foreign policies, and especially the United States and Southeast Asia?
Honestly, I couldn't even pick out Vietnam on a map.
Really?
But I've become curious, and I started search. And at the time, seriously believed that CETO, SEATO, Southeast Asian, that we would come to the aid of South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So, 40s and 50s when this were bugaboos and there was a lot of paranoia about the communists wanting to take over, domino theory. So, it seemed like a logical thing for us to do.
Okay, so it was going to be the Marine Corps, and you, like you said, you weren't particularly aware of Vietnam for sure. We became more and more aware of it as time went on. What about protests on the campus of the University of Arizona? Did you witness any of that?
No, I didn't, and I didn't even know what marijuana was in 1965. I came back 2 years later, and half the campus was stoned. It was just the transformation of our society that happened really fast. And no, when I was over in Vietnam, yes, I was aware of the protests. But before I went into the Marine Corps, I did not know. There weren't any protests. There were a few nuts over in Berkeley that might have been waving banners, but I didn't pay much attention to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that there was this transformation, and to some degree, this is getting ahead of our story a little, but I want to pick up on this. What do you think caused that transformation in those few years?
That is a mystery to me. I really don't know. All I saw was the change, and it was just a lot of it was happening on the campuses around the country, and we kind of like here in Arizona, whatever starts in California, we follow and trace, and we pick it up. So it came over to Arizona from California, I have no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And but I, like I say, I was in the military, I was in the Marine Corps, and I was doing all that. So I just came back and noticed the change, the hairstyles, the clothing, the sandals, it was a just total different setting from what I had left in 1965 when I came back in 1967.
Now, when you left in 65, you're going to OCS, Quantico,
yes.
Virginia. Describe OCS.
Actually, I'm sorry. It was 1966.
66. Okay. Very good. What was OCS like for you there?
OCS was the toughest thing that I've ever gone through in my life. It's normally 12 weeks, and they had condensed it down to 10 weeks because they needed officer material, and the Vietnam War was, taking casualties. They had to have replacements. And I'll just tell you, out of 50 that started OCS with me, 10 weeks later, there are only 29 of us still standing at formation when we graduated.
Why such a high washout rate?
Physical. Guys had old football injuries and sports injuries and stuff that they lied about or covered up. And they made sure that they put us through things that would find out if you had any old knee injuries or shoulder injuries, and then we had a peer review process that they would rate us. We would all rate each other from one to however many were left, and if you got rated down in the bottom two or three, you were out of there.
And where were you in this progression?
What was that?
Where were you ranked in this progression, do you think?
I was usually in the top five.
Okay, very good. So you said it was very, very difficult for you, the physical part, the
it's
training.
It's difficult for all of us.
Sure, sure.
I remember going out to run an obstacle course in December, and the bar was frozen, and my hand stuck to the bar. I mean, it was just... When I got through Officer Candidate School, I had a sprained elbow, I had a pulled groin muscle, I had a sore throat that wouldn't go away, and it was just really difficult. But it was intended to be that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it was. They wanted to eliminate all the sick, lame, and lazies, and those that couldn't think fast on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go on this thing called the Hill Trail, H-I-L-L, but we call it Hell Trail.
Sure.
And it was 3 miles of switchbacks up a steep hill, and there were, you know, people would just pass out, fall off the trail, and the attitude of Officer Candidate School is a lot different than regular enlisted boot camp. And enlisted boot camp, it's one for all for one. You know, if one guy messes up, everybody pays the price. When you're in an Officer Candidate program like I was in, you have to be able to look out for yourself and not take care of anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a strange, you know, because my inclination, if somebody fell down, is I was going to run over and pick them up. We weren't supposed to do that. Somebody else coming up in the back of the line would tend to someone who fell or passed out, but we weren't supposed to stop. We had to keep 40 inches behind the person in front of us, exactly 40 inches. And if you lag back or said, I can't keep up, whatever, you got what they call a leadership chit. And if you got 2 or 3 leadership chits, you were gone. Yeah, it was really tough.
Did you ever receive any of these chits?
No, sir.
Very good. What about the classes you were taking there? What kind of classes were you taking at Quantico?
Well, we had basic military orientation classes, military history, map and compass tactics, those kind of things, small unit tactics. And when but that was Officer Candidate School. Then we went to what they call the basic school as lieutenants, second lieutenants. And then they would, you would have a week where you would have an assignment to be, say, you 1 week you might be a squad leader, and then the next week you would be a platoon leader. And there would be 1 week in there where you would act as the company commander. So give us experience of doing all those different types of jobs.
So this basic school, was it at Quantico as well?
Yes.
Okay. So it was. You mentioned how very difficult it was, but it sounds like you did pretty well.
Yeah, I did pretty well. I got a hold of my service records years later, and I finished in the top 15% of my class, so I know I did.
Well, what do you think led to your success there?
Just the attitude that I had something to prove.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to redeem myself from getting arrested and kind of causing some embarrassment and shame to my family over that incident and being kicked out of college. I just kind of wanted to prove some things to myself and to other people. So I think that motivated me.
Okay. Now, when do you finish OCS in basic school?
Okay, I got commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps on December 10th of 1966. Had a little leave, came home, then reported back to basic school the 1st of January, and then graduated basic school in, I think it was about the middle of April. Got a little more leave and then was sent to Tracked Vehicle Officer School at Camp Pendleton, California.
Now, why tracked vehicles? Is this something that you wanted? That you applied for?
Something I was. When you're in a basic school, you're getting close to the end, they ask you to put down 3 of your choices for MOS.
Mm-hmm.
So I put down. I always had this thing about tanks. I just thought tanks were just really great, and I thought I'd want to be in tanks. So I put tanks down, then artillery, and third I put infantry. Well, had I been in a class
after mine, anyone that put infantry in one of the three choices, that's what they got. But I fortunately was able to be in the class before where if you put down tanks as your first choice, you would get your first choice. So I did. That's why I went to track vehicle officer school.
Okay, and that was in Camp Pendleton.
Right.
Well, describe what it was like there at this school out in California for you.
Well, that's where I really fell in love with tanks. They put me in the driver's compartment and said we had an automatic transmission, so it wasn't too difficult to drive. Just aim it. And they had us do everything that a tank crewman has to do. You know, adjusting the, you know, for fire, going out to the firing range, learning how to zero in your weapons, how to care for the suspension on the tank, how to brake track, replace road wheels, and all of that that goes along, and how to lubricate it, how to refuel it. And then they said, now you're not going to be able to get tank infantry tactics because we need you over in Vietnam, so you'll pick it up through on-the-job training, which was a big mistake because when I first got over to Vietnam, I knew how to operate a tank, but I knew nothing about operating with the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that later.
Sure, sure. What type of classroom time did you do here at Pendleton?
We spent I'd say 20% of the time in the classroom, and the other 80% was out in the field or on the tank ramp working on the tanks or driving them or shooting them or something.
Mm-hmm. What kind of classes would you take there, this 20% of the time?
Well, in your gunnery classes, you'd have to learn how to zero in your weapons. You'd have to learn how to use your ballistic computer. You'd have to know how to stow your ammunition so that, you couldn't have any moisture on the base of the round.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause if it rusted, and you put that round in the main gun chamber, it was liable to pull your cartridge in half. And that had happened a few times over Vietnam where they allowed moisture to get down the barrel. And then it rusted the cartridge to the inside of the barrel. And when they went to extract it, it ripped in half. You know, some real problems like that. So all these little tricks of the trade they taught us.
What did you find to be the most difficult thing at the track school?
I don't know. Not really. Nothing that I couldn't handle, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as time is wearing on here, we're looking at 1966, 1967, and as we're going into 1968, I guess. How aware are you of how the war is being prosecuted in Vietnam, of course? Were you following it closely?
Not too much. All I knew is that the odds were, really high that once I finished basic school that I was going to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
There was a chance I wouldn't, but Kelly, I wanted to go. I was very curious about what was going on over there, and I wanted to see it myself. And I would have been really disappointed had I got orders to go elsewhere. I wanted to go to Vietnam.
Very good. When do you get your orders to go to Vietnam?
As soon as basic school was over, while I was in tank school in Pendleton, I got orders to Westpac. Now, Westpac could mean that you'd go as far as Okinawa, and that's as far as you'd go, or it could mean you'd go on to Vietnam. So I really didn't know for sure at the time until I got to Okinawa if I was actually going to Vietnam.
Is that right? Well, describe your trip over to Okinawa for me. How did you get there?
Yeah, we flew, and I don't remember much about that flight except that it was long, and there were a whole lot of us Marines on the plane. I don't remember much about it.
Mm-hmm.
What I do remember is when we hit landed in Okinawa and got off the plane, the humidity just about suffocated me. I mean, it was just awful. And so they put us up in the BOQ there, bachelor officer quarters, and I had a room to myself with a little fan up, mounted up on my wall near the ceiling. And I just laid in that bed, and just the sweat soaked the sheets, and the fan blowing on me evaporated the sweat a little bit, and that's how I managed to get a little sleep. We were there 3 days, and then I got my orders to get on a plane and head to Vietnam.
So you got your orders at the end of the 3 days
mm-hmm.
that you were there. So you were in Okinawa yeah. waiting to see where you would be assigned at this time.
I have told people there's nothing more worthless in the world than a green second lieutenant with no orders trying to decide what's going to happen to him.
So you were obviously very pleased with receiving the orders to go to Vietnam.
Yeah, I was. And when we flew into Vietnam and I looked down, I remember looking out the window and I saw one of our, I don't know if it was a destroyer, cruiser, or what it was, firing inland. And I thought, whoa, okay, welcome to Vietnam. And then we landed, and we landed in Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
They put us up in some tents along the runway there, and no one got any sleep all night. Jet planes were coming in and taking off all night long. And I don't know how close we were to the runway, but it sounded like we were only about 100 meters from the runway. And I didn't know that a few nights earlier, a rocket had impacted one of those tents and killed a bunch of people. I had no idea. Fortunately, didn't know about that. But we spent a very awful sleepless night and then got called up to this little shack, and there were 16 of us Marine Lieutenant tank officers that had come over together. So 8 of us were assigned to go up north to the 3rd Marine Division. 8 of us went south to the 1st Marine Division.
Okay.
And as a little aside, of all of the 8 of us that went up north, were either wounded or killed before the end of that year.
Incredible. What did you think of the hustle and bustle of this crowded place, Da Nang? So incredibly busy, so many people. You just got off the plane, and here you are in this foreign environment. Describe what that was like, if you could, please.
Yeah, it just seemed like we're in just a small city that, you know, jeeps and trucks hustling around, people knowing where they're going from point A to point B, and planes landing, taking off. It was pretty busy.
All right, you received your orders to go up north. Did you know exactly where it was going to be up north?
I knew I was going to 3rd Tank Battalion headquarters up by Phu Bai.
Okay.
And 3rd Tank Battalion was actually located a little bit away from Phu Bai at a place called Giale, G-I-A-L-E. That's 2 words.
Mm-hmm.
And all the... Yeah, when I got there, I noticed that they weren't living in sandbag bunkers or anything. They were living in what they call hooches, H-O-O-T-C-H-E-S, which were made out of wood, plywood, with corrugated tin roofs, and they had screened-in windows. And that's where we lived for a while. I was assigned to be the assistant S3. The 3 office is the one that, you got S1 is intelligence, I'm not sure what S2, S3 is tactics, and S4 is supply. So I was the assistant to the major who did the briefings for the colonel and his staff every evening and tell him where the tanks were deployed and if they'd been involved in any encounters. And I did that for about a month in Jale. But I got to tell you a little story about what happened there. I'd been in there about a week and was thinking, hey, you know, this this war is not too bad. This is kind of nice here. And then one night, there was a South Vietnamese artillery unit that fired a short round, and it landed on one of those huts that I was describing, one of those hooches, and it's full of Navy Seabees. It hit right on the roof and showered shrapnel down. And I went over there because their compound was adjacent to ours, and I was curious. I walked over, and they still had all the sheets on every single bunk were bloody. And that means to me every single one of those guys that were sleeping in that hooch that night were a casualty, either killed or wounded. And that's when I began to think, you know what, you could really get hurt over here, and it could be totally by accident. You're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I think at that point, the great adventure fun thing that I was heading off into, I started to worry a little bit about maybe it's not going to be such a great fun adventure after all.
Now, how old were you? 25, 26?
I was 25.
25 years old. What were your duties here as a second lieutenant assistant to this briefing officer, to this major? What were you doing on a daily basis?
I would read all the communications that came into the battalion, and I would help put together the information for the evening briefing. That was my main duty.
And you were doing this for a month, I believe you said?
Yeah, and occasionally the colonel would go out on a field trip out in the field to visit some of the deployed units, and he would bring along mail and some beer. And I would go along as I would sit in the back. The colonel would sit up front with his driver, and I got to see where we had all of our tank units deployed. We had one close call up in a place called Jolin, G-I-O-L-I-N-H, up by the DMZ. Our Jeep pulled in, and we had just gotten out of the Jeep, and I heard a whistling noise and saw everybody running. So I thought, well, I'm not just going to stand here. I'm going to run, too. And the colonel jumped into a trench, and I jumped right in on top of him. But they say the one that you hear, you don't have to worry about. It's the one you don't hear. But I was pretty green, and I didn't know what was going on. So that was my first experience with incoming artillery. The North Vietnamese had artillery, rockets, and mortars that they had hidden up in the southern half of the demilitarized zone and up in maybe even some north of the Benhai River, especially their 130-millimeter artillery. They could fire about 20 miles, and so they had them up there terrorizing everybody that was within range up in the northern part of I Corps. I won't say terrorizing, but you never knew when they were going to drop one in on you. So you were always alert and always listening, and never, you know, always, I got myself trained to wherever I went, I always knew where there was a bunker or a trench so that I could jump in one without thinking if I had to real fast.
Sure. Now, while you were working here, did you ever have any desire to be in combat with the tanks?
Boy, that's a hard question. I was curious, yes. I wanted to know what it was like, but I was not. I knew I wasn't going to be facing any enemy tanks. So the thing that we worried about was anti-tank rockets and mines. I think it progressed the more I was over there, the less anxious I was to get involved in any kind of combat. I figured I was going to have to do it. It was going to be part of my job. When it came to me, I would pray that I did it right and none of my men got killed and I didn't screw up. But as far as chomping at the bit and saying I can't wait to get out there, no, I wouldn't say that.
Well, where were you assigned, or to what duties were you assigned after this initial month?
Okay, there was a place, there was a strong point just 2 miles south of the demilitarized zone, and it was called Con Tien, C-O-N-T-H-I-E-N, that's two words. And Con Tien was a main, they call it the linchpin in McNamara's wall, which was high-tech system that McNamara and General Westmoreland had devised to keep the North Vietnamese from infiltrating across the demilitarized zone into South Vietnam. So we were going to be part of a system of strong, what they called it, the SPOS, Strong Point Obstacle System, of fire bases mutually supported with artillery, and then we would be able to go out and look for the North Vietnamese coming across that demilitarized zone. So one of the lieutenants that had come over with me on the plane, his name was Tom Barry, B-A-R-R-Y. Tom had picked up 3 Purple Hearts in about 2 weeks up there at Contient from incoming mortars and artillery and stuff. Well, the policy at that time was if you had 2 Purple Hearts, they would pull you out of the field. Because if you had 3 Purple Hearts, you had to go back stateside. Well, Tom already got his 3rd Purple Heart. Before they could get him out of there, he picked up 2 in one day. So I was called into the colonel's office and said, Jim, you're going to go up to Contian. You're going to take over the 1st Platoon of Alpha Company. And I said, swallowed hard and had a few butterflies, but said, you know, aye, aye, sir. And 2 days later, I was up in Dong Ha, D-O-N-G-H-A, 2 words. Dong Ha is where the 3rd Marine Division had their supply, I guess you'd call it a giant supply base. And a lot of the units had their headquarters there. So Alpha Company of 3rd Tank Battalion was located at Dong Ha. So I reported in there, and then the next day I went on up to Contian. Contian was a pretty bad place because they were under a siege. A siege was beginning at that time, where General Giap, G-I-A-P, had decided that he was going to put pressure on the Marine bases there with artillery, rockets, and mortars. He was going to put enough pressure on them that we would pull out. So it was getting increasingly more dangerous every day. So I knew when I went up there to relieve Tom Barry that I was going into a really perilous situation.
Sure. Now let me add this, if I might. I know that you are an expert of sorts on the battles there at Contian, and especially the siege, that you've written a book.
Right.
On this, a very credible book. I read it yesterday, as a matter of fact. I think you did a really good job on that. So please feel free to go into as much detail as you would like in your description of the you know, McNamara's Wall, the Trace, Contian, and the siege as well.
Okay. Well, there was an area that we call Leatherneck Square, which, if you looked in a map, the bases formed kind of almost a square, not quite. But you had at the northwest corner was Contian, and then the northeast corner was Geolin, about 6 miles away. And there was a bulldozed out strip that linked Contian and Geolin. It was started out as 200 meters wide. It was eventually bulldozed out to be 600 meters wide. And you could look from Contian, you could look east towards Jolin and look beyond Jolin out into the South China Sea. You could even see our warships patrolling up and down along the coast there. Directly to our south, if you're at Contian and you look south, you would see one of the fire bases called Charlie 2 that was a couple of miles south of us, and then another couple of miles south of us was a place called Cam Lo, C-A-M-L-O, 2 words. And then east of Cam Lo was Dong Ha. So that formed a roughly square. The eastern border of the square would have been Highway 1, southern border was Route 9. The western border of the square was Route 561. That was also called the MSR, main supply route, mm-hmm. for us up at Charlie 2 in Contien. And so when I got there in September of 1967, the siege was really getting going. And I walked in and took over, introduced myself to the platoon, and the rains hadn't started yet. So the ground was still still baked hard, sun-baked hard, dry. And when tanks moved around, they put up a lot of dust. And so everything at Contien, the bunkers, the vehicles, the individual Marines themselves were all coated with this pink dust. And that was what I thought it was going to be like. I had no idea that the monsoon was coming pretty soon. And that pink dust was all going to turn to chocolate mud, but that came later.
Now, what did you think about this idea for this wall of McNamara? What was your impression when you were there?
I really didn't have much of an opinion about it. All the opinions that I had, pro and con, came later when I started studying or researching why we were there and what we were doing there. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it seemed to make sense to me.
All right, here you are, 25 years old. You are facing your first battle command position. What's going through your mind here?
What's going through my mind is I don't want to do anything stupid to get somebody hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main thing. I didn't want to do anything ignorant, uninformed, or stupid that I would regret, and I had a learning curve there. I had to learn a lot real fast, and it was all new to me, and so I just was just constantly eyes, ears, brain alert for so I could know what was going on, and plus I didn't want to get myself hurt. I didn't want to walk around out in the open and have an artillery shell drop in on me either. I had to find out what that was all about. And I knew enough that when you're a young lieutenant like that, you have to rely on your experienced non-commissioned officers. And I had a platoon sergeant, Gunnery Sergeant Hopkins, who had been in Korea, been in the Marine Corps about 18 years. So one of the first things I did was take my tank over to where Gunny Hopkins was, and Gunnery Sergeant Hopkins, and introduce myself and find out what's up and who do I have and what are the names of the men in the platoon, where are the tanks located. I had to get myself oriented. And
sure.
So when I pulled over there to that northern part of the perimeter, the gunny's tank was all buttoned up, and his main gun barrel was pointing out to the northeast. And so I, as I pulled up alongside of him, all of a sudden their loader, this corporal, stood up and was waving me away. Get away, get away, get away. So I, what's your problem, And then within about 5 seconds, a recoilless rifle round came in and landed right between our two tanks. And so that was what
Wow.
that was all about, is two tanks attract fire. But anyway, I managed to hook up with Gunny Hopkins, and we talked, and I found out where all the tanks were located, who the tank crewmen were, who was in charge, what the infantry unit in charge of security for Contien at that time was the 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. So my next step was to go touch bases with the CO up there, the commanding officer, and his staff. And I did that. And so that was pretty much my first day at Contien.
What was your relationship like with Gunny Hopkins?
Real good. He was a guy from West Virginia. His life's ambition was to drive a beer truck when he retired from the Marine Corps. And he was just a good old country boy. I think some senior NCOs like that will resent the young officer coming in. Mm-hmm. He was glad that I came there because it took a lot of the pressure off him. He didn't have to go to the CO's briefings. He didn't have to run around and to be checking on every tank to make sure that everybody was, you know, you have to patrol the lines. So our lines were tanks, and I'd have to go from tank to tank to tank to tank, sometimes ducking into bunkers and dunking into trenches if we started getting any incoming. And so when I got there, no longer did he have to do that. And he was very happy to have me there.
Had he worked with your friend Lieutenant Barry earlier?
Yes. Okay. No, as a matter of fact, no. Hopkins had gotten there about 4 or 5 days before me. He was also new.
Okay. So there was somewhat of a learning curve for him there as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how many tanks were in this?
Five tanks and a platoon.
Okay. Could you describe your relationship with the men who served under you there in the platoon?
Well, I was the new guy. A lot of the tankers had been through the fighting that had gone on that spring and summer around the DMZ, and they were getting short. They were what they call short timers,
mm-hmm.
and they pretty much been there, done that, seen it, and they didn't want them. They were pretty much like, I'm not getting out of my tank. I've only got 3 or 4 days to go, and I'm not going to get killed here.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit difficult to get those guys together to sit down and have a little discussion about anything, because they didn't want to get out of their tanks, and I understood. So, but I told myself, well, in a few days they'll all be gone, I'll get all new replacements. So I will no longer be the new guy lieutenant, I'll be the old salt lieutenant, because I will have been there before the new guys that came in.
Sure.
You understand my thinking?
Sure, sure.
And so, yes, they... I lost, didn't lose, but about, there were 20 men on the 5 tanks. Almost half of those guys just got on a helicopter and flew out one morning. And the same helicopter that flew them out had brought in their replacements. So now for half the platoon, I was the old salt. For the other half, I was still the new guy, but... it worked out pretty good.
What does that mean to you, a young lieutenant, just taking over this platoon, and after a few days, half of your platoon, with all of this experience, is gone, and you have another brand-new fresh face is coming in? What does that mean to you?
I was glad to see him go.
Really?
Because they were basically worthless.
Okay.
They weren't even going to stick their head out of the turret. I didn't understand until years later what they had gone through that summer.
Mm-hmm.
But they had been on some very bad operations, seeing a lot of people killed and wounded. They were the survivors, and they wanted to go home. And I didn't blame them one bit.
Sure. Did it bother you to lose their combat experience in your platoon?
No.
Rather have them gone.
The new people that came in were good and good to go, and they looked to me for leadership. They weren't like, oh God, here comes that lieutenant again. It was like, you know, they were glad to see me.
Sure. Now, you arrived, let's see, it would have been at the very beginning of the siege of Cantien?
It had started right after the election, right around the 1st of September.
Mm-hmm.
The pressure began to get serious as far as the amount of incoming and the ambushing of the infantry patrols around the area. It started to pick up right around the very end of August and the first part of September. So I got there September 10th, and it was already pretty much full-blown siege by then.
We should probably also point out that although there was this incredibly intense siege that lasted, like you say, for 40 days,
right.
Cantien was a place of an awful lot of activity prior to the siege itself, and a number of operations there against
right.
North Vietnamese units in, I guess, beginning 1965, with Hastings and Operations Prairie, etc.
Yeah, 66, yeah.
So you knew that you were headed into a place that was incredibly busy and incredibly dangerous. And shortly after you get there, the siege begins.
Right.
Knowing what you knew about the history of Kantian and its position, what are you trying to do mentally to prepare yourself for what you're seeing there?
You mean before I got there?
No, when you got there, when you were on the ground, you saw it firsthand.
I'm just trying to, I'm basically trying to make sure that, you know, we stay in communication with battalion there, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, and that I'm on top of things, you know, and I'm communicating so that we don't get caught in a position where we have to go out and rescue somebody and we don't have ammunition or we're all out of fuel. You know, I just wanted to make sure that we were good to go, as they say. If they called on us to go do something. But then the rains came. We had a night attack. We traded. I'm getting ahead of myself. We would take turns occupying a firing space on the northern part of the perimeter. So every night a different tank would go over there. So the night it was my tank's turn to be there. We had a major probe of the northern perimeter, and it was my first experience really in combat, as you would say, because we could see they'd fired flares out once the shooting started, and we could see figures running towards us. We fired quite a few rounds from our machine guns, and we fired out quite a few 90-millimeter rounds. We also knocked out a machine gun that was about 800 meters out. We knocked that out, and the next morning, when the sun came up, we looked out and did not see an enemy body anywhere out there. Oh, we saw a lot of holes in the ground and a lot of holes in the wire that had been blown up by artillery, and I didn't know if it was our artillery or their artillery, but I know when the battalion commander came by, the colonel and the XO came by, and he said, did you get any of them, Lieutenant? And I said, well, I think so, sir, but we don't see any out there. He said, well, yeah, they have people that come haul their KIAs away, but I want you to know you did a good job. So I said, thank you, sir, and he moved on. And what I found out later is that 4 Marines were killed and I think 12 wounded. But it kind of was a senseless attack to me because it was nothing like the original May 8th attack where a couple of battalions had tried to overrun Kantian and had been beaten back. Now, this was probably only a company of North Vietnamese. And we began to think, well, maybe they're just probing to see how strong we are because there was no way they could overrun us. We're too strong over there. And so that was my first experience. Nobody got hurt. We didn't know how much damage we had caused because we couldn't see the results of it, but all we knew was that they hadn't gotten through the wire, and we were pretty exhilarated over the whole thing after it was all over. Actually, I mean, you know, after you're in a fight like that, you don't think about anything but the fighting itself, you know, spotting the enemy, firing the guns, da-da-da-da-da. And then after it's all over and you sit back, that's when your hands start to shake and you you know, then you feel the anxiety and everything. But during that actual attack, it was just take care of business. And I remember coming away from there with a feeling of confidence that we could handle anything that they threw at us. If they tried to overrun us, it would be a pretty horrendous defeat for them because we were very strong. If you've ever been in a situation like that and you see our machine guns crisscrossing across the open area, the red tracers interlocking, our artillery coming in, and our mortars firing and everything, you just feel like, you know, we're invincible.
If you could, please describe the defensive setup of Kantian. How were the defenses set up there?
Okay, well, we had a battalion of Marines. But we only, at that time, we had two companies, which is about 400 men on the hill itself. And then about 400 or 500 meters south of us was a little tree-covered hill called Yankee Station. And we had two companies out there as a reaction force, so they could go, if there was a penetration of the perimeter, the reaction force would be able to respond. And we had a couple of tanks out with the reaction force, too. Then that was around the perimeter. We had the infantry, and spaced periodically along the perimeter, we had one of our tanks. And each tank had a bunker that they had built, a pretty flimsy sandbag and ammunition crate bunker. But anyway, that was a place to get out of the tank and go in and cook your sea rations and sleep. And then inside the perimeter, we had two landing zones, one for bringing in personnel and evacuating casualties. That was by the battalion aid station. And then we had another landing zone on the other side of the perimeter, which was for bringing in supplies. Then further up the hill, we had a battery of 105-millimeter artillery. We had 81-millimeter mortars. We had four deuce, they're 4.2-inch mortars. And then we had a couple of recoilless rifles, searchlights. The Marine Corps had a tank-destroying vehicle called an Ontos, spelled capital O-N-T-O-S, mounted six 106-millimeter recoilless rifles on it. We had several of those little Ontos tank destroyers inside the perimeter. And then Contien, the hill actually was three little hillocks connected with a saddle. And the whole area of Contien was about two city blocks. Each one of the peaks of those three hills, we had an outpost for the artillery observers. So we had an OP1, OP2 in the middle, and an OP3 on the eastern flank of the hill. And that was pretty much it. The Army had some vehicles there. There was a vehicle called a Duster that was a tracked vehicle, and it mounted two Bofors, or a, I don't know if it's both two Bofors or one Bofors, but anyway, they were two 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. The Army had a couple of those Dusters there, and they also had some trucks that had quad 50 machine guns mounted on the trucks. I think that pretty much explains what we had there.
So you felt pretty confident that you could repel a North Vietnamese attack?
Yeah, but because our big trump card was we could get helicopter and aircraft to come in too, and then we had artillery batteries at all the other places around that I had described earlier on Leatherneck Square. You know, Jo Lynn, Dong Ha, Cam Lo, and Charlie too. So we could put a firestorm of artillery fire down on any enemy that was trying to attack us.
Did you also have support from the artillery support from the Navy?
We could call on that too. Yeah, I didn't see much of that. I think a year or two later they had the USS New Jersey offshore firing in, but I was gone home by then.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, in September, the siege sets in. What did you think the North Vietnamese were trying to do? What do you think they were trying to accomplish with the siege of this area?
I think they were trying to kill so many of us that we would abandon the base.
Okay.
And pull back. To make it untenable for us to be there.
Now, they expended a tremendous amount of their resources, human material, etc. Explain to me what it was like, from your perspective, going through this siege and feel free to start at the beginning and work your way through.
Well, switching hands here, my left hand's getting numb. I was extremely impressed with the bravery of those Marines, particularly the engineers and what we call cannon cockers, guys in the artillery, because we would start getting incoming. Maybe it was artillery, and the artillery men would go out while the incoming was crashing around. They'd get out behind their guns, and they would fire counter-battery fire. And I was in my tank one time looking out through the vision rings, and I was looking across about 30 meters or 40 meters away at the artillery battery near us, or the gun, not the battery, but the gun near us, the 105-millimeter gun. And a round, incoming round, landed on the parapet, the sandbag parapet that they had around their enclosure there. And all three guys in there went down wounded. Three more guys came running out, pulled them out of danger, picked up an artillery shell, put it in the breech, and started carrying out the fire mission. And I thought, God, those guys are brave.
Now, these three men were from the same battery, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's the engineers who they would have to go out and work in the minefields.
Mm-hmm.
And, they had that look in their eyes like, you know, dead men walking, because if any incoming came in while they were out working in the minefield, they had no prayer. They couldn't run.
Mm-hmm.
They just have to lay on the ground and pray. And our get emotional talking about this.
That's perfectly fine.
But anyway, I think that impressed me the most.
Mm-hmm. What type of tactics did the NVA employ in this siege most typically?
They were just there to mainly just, you know, put pressure on us. Like, we would have snipers that would hide out in the brush and then, you know, try to pick off a few Marines walking around. And if the sniper was bad, you know, he didn't hit anybody, nobody shot back at him because they didn't want a replacement to come in who was a better shot. So they would, I remember a couple of guys being brought down to the aid station who had been hit by a sniper. I saw a lot of shocking things. I mean, I would have to go my route from my tank's position up to the CO's bunker on OP1, or just below OP1. I would have to go by the battalion aid station, and sometimes I'd walk by there. I'd see dead Marines laying under a blanket with their boot toes pointing up and puddles of blood underneath them. And, this is war. This is what it's all about. I always wondered what it was about, and I finally got to find out.
For sure.
One day I went to a briefing, and I came back, and the two Marines that were in the bunker next to us were dead. An artillery shell came in and just... I talked to him about a half hour before I went to the briefing, just so something like, you guys got any more, or we got some extra sea rations. Would you guys like some Franks and beans? And one guy said, no, we got plenty of that. So then I come back from the briefing 2 hours later, and both of those guys are dead. You know, that was the thing that got me, was how you could just be alive 1 minute, and an hour later you're dead. That was the main thing that you don't think about things like that if you had never been in a combat situation. You don't think about how you can be here 1 minute and gone the next.
No, how?
And despite that, and we all knew that, what I just came away from then, and I'll carry the rest of my life, is how everybody, nobody went and sniveled and crawled under a tank and cried and said, I can't take it anymore. They just went out and did their jobs and did what they had to do.
How did this affect you personally? Did this create a sense of fatalism, or was, I would think...
Very much so. I began to... Well, it was a strange mixture. I got real religious. Started reading my... I had a pocket Bible. I started reading that frequently, particularly the Psalms. And they provided a certain amount of comfort. And then... But I also had this... when your number's up, it's up. You know, not that there's some great plan in mind for who's going to survive and who's not. I just figured if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that's it, you're gone. So that might be a little contradiction there.
What kind of sense did you get from the men who were around you? How did it affect them? Was it something similar? Was it something different?
Well, I think it was pretty much some men become, you know, turn to their religion for support. Others turn to their family. I hadn't told my family that I was in Vietnam. I didn't want them to worry about me.
They did not know that you were in Vietnam.
I would write letters home because my letters home wouldn't say that I was in Vietnam. They would say there would be an FPO and a number. And so I told them I was in Okinawa. I didn't want them to know I was in Vietnam. And that's a long story, and I'll get to that, I guess, later. But yeah, so I couldn't really write home and say, gee, this is what I'm going through, and pray for me, and all this kind of stuff. I didn't have that kind of support.
So your family didn't know you were in Vietnam the entire time you were there?
They found out I'd been in country about 8 months, and I started thinking, you know, that you're being kind of selfish. You think you're being kind to your family, but you're not. What if something happens to you? What if you get killed? And they're going to find out that you were in Vietnam. They're not going to be prepared for it. So I wrote a letter home, and I fessed up, and I told my mom and my sister and brother. I said, I haven't been very truthful with you. I've been in Vietnam all this time, but I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm going to make it home okay, so don't worry about me. And then a week later, I got wounded.
What was their reaction to your letter? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. I think my mom was kind of upset because she had believed that I wasn't in harm's way. But anyway, I made it home okay.
Well, let's go back to Con Tien, back to the sea.
All right.
You mentioned the sniper fire was very, very common. What else were the NVA doing in
we had 60 millimeter mortars, and they had a 61 millimeter mortar.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small one that of the mortars. That's the smaller one, and they would just about dusk. A couple of those guys would get out in the shrubs or trees in the bushes somewhere, you know, 500, 600 meters, 800 meters away, and wait till it got dark, and then they would drop two or three mortar shells, boom, 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 then pick up their mortar tube and run away. So by the time the mortar shells landed on us, those guys were long gone. There was no way to fire counter battery, and we couldn't see where they were firing from because they were in defilade, or they were in the bushes, or they were behind the hill or something. And so a lot of the counter-mortar fire that we tried to do was just for morale purposes. It wasn't hitting anything. Where we were very successful, though, was our artillery observers up on the outpost, OP1, OP2, OP3, they could see if the enemy was firing artillery at us. They could spot that. And they could have counter battery fire on that location just real quick. And also we had aircraft up flying around during daylight hours now. Nighttime was different, but during daylight hours, they would fire at us, and we could pretty much hit them with counter battery fire, or hit real close to where we could make them think twice about doing it again from that location. But the worst part really was the... and then the other thing that was really bad and caused a lot of casualties is mortars, when they come in, they just make a whoosh sound. They don't make a screaming artillery-type shell or rocket sound. They just kind of make a whoosh sound coming down. So if during the day with all the hustle and bustle of trucks moving around and helicopters flying and our 105 artillery firing, you could have a mortar shell coming right down on top of you and not hear it coming. And that was the thing that we all worried about, is we couldn't hear those mortars coming in on us. And the first time you knew that you were being targeted was when the first shell landed. So I think that was probably the worst part. And I, being the platoon leader, I couldn't just stay in my tank or my bunker all the time. I had to be going around the perimeter every day checking on my tanks and my tank crews. And I had a real, and then going to the CO's briefing up the hill every afternoon. I had a pretty, I was in a lot of danger there, and it was pretty stressful.
But how many of these mortar rounds would you take there at Contian in a given day?
I don't know. Maybe sometimes 100, 150 rounds of mortars, maybe a couple hundred rounds of artillery, and sometimes we'd get some 140-millimeter or 122-millimeter rockets they would fire in on us. The rockets, if they fired in the daytime, they would fire them and then boogie out of there, the North Vietnamese would, because we could have counter-battery on those rockets right away. The rockets left a trail, so where they were fired from, you know, it was a dead giveaway.
Sure. Well, tell me about your artillery. They had artillery positions, like you say, hidden.
They had artillery
DMZ
up in the southern half of the demilitarized zone. Mm-hmm. We weren't supposed to be up there. You ask what we thought. Well, one of the things that we were real frustrated about is that we were only supposed to go up to the southern border of the demilitarized zone. We weren't supposed to go in the demilitarized zone. Well, that's where the enemy was. That's where they had their artillery gun. They had all their guns and rockets and artillery up in the demilitarized zone, and we couldn't go in after them, and that was very frustrating. We could drop bombs on them. Our artillery could fire at them, but we weren't supposed to go send any troops in after them. We did that during Operation Hastings. We went in on the ground with tanks and infantry and everything, but since then, we weren't allowed to go up in there. And that was very, very, very frustrating to us, that we couldn't go get those guys that were shooting at us.
And what's that do to morale in general there?
Say again?
What does that do to morale in general among Marines?
Well, it's more of a frustration thing. I wouldn't say that we were sitting around sulking and depressed about it. It's, We were there very much for each other, and you know, the guy on your left, the guy on your right, we were there looking out for each other and trying to keep each other alive, and we weren't too worried about the grand scheme of things. But it was a source of maybe anger, just anger and frustration, especially if you lost a friend to incoming. And then you knew that you couldn't go out and get the guys that were shooting at you.
Sure. What would you do as this tank platoon commander on a daily basis during this time? What were your duties?
Well,
take me through
the range,
average day.
Yeah, we were going outside the perimeter to escort the engineers out into the minefield and back, and occasionally if an infantry unit got ambushed or something, we'd send out a tank reaction force. But when the rains came on September 12th, like 17 inches in 24 hours in that area of Northern I Corps.
Incredible.
Roads washed out, bunkers collapsed, trenches had 3 feet of water in them. The whole thing changed. Everything we did changed because we could no longer move around the perimeter without sinking down in the mud. And so we pretty much became stationary at that point. And that was, did I say the 12th? No, I think it was more like maybe the 15th. I'd been there about 5 days when the rain happened.
Okay. Tell me what the rain does to your defenses there within the perimeter.
Well, one thing that the monsoon has a lot of overcast and drizzle. Once that big deluge happened, that was the end of the big heavy rain. From then on, it was just misting and sprinkling, and it went from being blazing hot to cold. And in fact, they brought us out some rainy weather gear to wear because, you know, we were damp in the drizzle and it was cold at night. Cold for us down into the 40s, but it still felt really cold. Anyway, the enemy now could move around, especially in the fog. They could get closer to us.
Mm-hmm.
Snipers could get closer to the wire. That's and the guys shooting the mortars, of course, they were now shooting in the blind because they really couldn't see Contien very good because there was so much fog and mist. So their view of us was impaired, and our view of them was impaired. Walking around in the mud was kind of a lifesaver, though. I remember one time I got bracketed. I was out there walking for some reason, and an artillery shell came in, landed about 20 meters from me, but hit in the mud, and all the shrapnel shot straight up in the air. Had it been hard ground, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I remember one time a Marine was from the artillery, one of the artillery guns, had gone over to supply and picked up a case of sea rations, had on his shoulder, and he was walking back towards his unit when we were getting some incoming. Well, there was nothing he could do. You know, he tried to run, and he stepped in some muck, and he sunk down about 3 feet, 2 feet maybe. And so all he could do is just bend forward at the waist into the mud and pray. Well, he didn't get hit by, as it turned out, he didn't get hit by any shrapnel, but he started yelling for help. And people, of course, looked out and thought this guy had been hit. But all it was is he was stuck in the mud and couldn't extricate himself. When they finally pulled him out, he was covered with chocolate mud from head to toe. And I remember him walking over to a shell crater that was full of water and just sitting down there rinsing himself off. The mud and then the main supply route from Dong Ha to Contien got washed out. And so our helicopters had to resupply us then. We could no longer get truck convoy supplies. We had to have all of our supplies and our ammunition brought in by helicopter.
What did the rain do to that?
I don't know. I don't think it did affect it that much. And if anything, it maybe even helped, because if it was foggy, the North Vietnamese couldn't really see where to aim, because they would try to shoot down those helicopters coming in.
What about other air support? Did the rains, and you mentioned the overcast, did that limit
it anyway? Like our air support diminished greatly.
Mm-hmm.
Once we had the, what the French call the Krachin, or Krachin, I don't know, C-R-A-C-H-I-N, which was the monsoon,
mm-hmm,
with the drizzly rain and the cold, cloudy overcast.
I guess the positive aspect of the monsoon season was that it slowed the enemy down as well,
right,
and limited their capabilities.
Yeah, and there one tank platoon, a whole tank platoon got stuck in the mud outside of Contien, and the story is that they were operating with an infantry unit, and they came across some old, some ancient rice paddies. Well, they sucked up all that rain And now a couple of the tanks tried to go across there and sank in, were stuck. Then the platoon leader and the platoon sergeant told the infantry, you know, we can't go through there. So this hot-headed captain came out and pulled his pistol and pointed it at the platoon sergeant and said, you get in there and get those tanks out of there or I'm going to blow your blankety-blank head away. So the gunny said, okay, sir. Aye, aye, sir. So then his tank got stuck. Now there's three tanks stuck.
No.
And then the lieutenant, who was, he'd been around for a while. He was pretty experienced. He wasn't a new boot like I was. Anyway, he also ended up. So all five tanks were stuck in the mud. And this is all happening about the same time. And so what the tankers had to do was disable their radios, take the firing pins out of all their guns, make sure the tanks couldn't be fired, and then padlock the hatches so the hatches couldn't be opened, and then go off on foot with the infantry. But interesting was that none of the tanks were touched by the North Vietnamese, and our thinking is they were just as miserable as we were. And they didn't want to go traipsing around out in the countryside in the mud and all that, so they were holed up too. So as a result, they managed to extricate all of those tanks, no worse for the wear, and that was the end of that.
Sure, I would think that the NVA would know that the Americans would eventually be back for those tanks, and didn't want to spend a lot of time around them either. I would think.
Yeah, but they didn't mess with the tanks or the retriever crews that came out to get them. They didn't bother them.
Well, that takes me to a good point here. What does all this rain do to the tanks? You're in charge of a tank platoon. How does all this heavy rain at first, of course, and
yeah, well,
the constant rain, how does it affect?
We're immobile. We're not going to be able to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go anywhere, we're going to have to stay on a hard-packed road. We can't go out off the road. So we're road-bound.
Mm-hmm.
And that constant moisture did affect one or two of the tanks. We're just sitting there. Then we tried to start them. We couldn't get them to start. So that was a problem.
So what about this heavy deluge, you say over 17 inches in a 24-hour period? What does this do? You mentioned that it washed out the supply road, but what about the local hard pack around Con Tien? What did this do there? Did it completely immobilize your platoon?
Well, we really didn't have hard pack around Con Tien.
Okay.
We just had a road coming in the south gate and heading south to Charlie 2 and Cam Lo and Dong Ha. Well, Highway 9 was paved. That was the road from Cam Lo to Dong Ha that was paved. But the CBs and the Marine Engineers had put in a crushed rock road along 561 that headed from Cam Lo all the way up to Con Tien. And that would support our tanks. The problem was that where the culvert was there, just the place called the Washout, the road washed out. So that, for about 2 weeks, we were getting nothing but a helicopter resupply. And then the engineers and CBs came in and replaced that with a bridge that would support armored vehicles. And then the road was open again. But as far as maneuvering around the perimeter of Con Tien or Joe... Oh, they also had three tanks stuck in the mud outside of Joe Lynn, I found out. Yeah, it was not good. Not good tank time. Not a good time for tanks.
Imagine not. Well, is there anything else you would like to cover while we're here at Con Tien?
For the siege
mentality
thing there, the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, came in the first part of October and replaced the 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. The 1st Battalion, 9th Marines had been given the nickname the Walking Dead because they had taken so many casualties around the DMZ fighting that spring and summer And they were also the ones, I don't know if you ever heard of Operation Buffalo, but the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, almost got wiped out on that operation.
Right.
And so here, that was in July, that was July 2nd of 67. So here we are in October. This is a new battalion coming in with new officers, been completely rebuilt with replacements. And I found them rather irksome to work with. The 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines that were there first seemed to understand what tanks did, how they operated, and how to use them. The 1st Battalion, 9th Marines came in, and right away I was having conflicts with their staff. They wanted me to have two of my... We have four crewmen on a tank. They wanted two of my crewmen to be on the lines during the night, out of the tank, and manning a foxhole. And so I had to go up there and practically pound the desk in front of the major and the colonel and tell him, there are four crewmen on a tank because it takes four crewmen to operate a tank in a firefight. You can do it with two. Say they decide to come through the lines and we have to move our tank. Well, if we don't have anybody sitting in the driver's compartment, who's going to drive the tank? You know, and they looked at me like, oh, you got a point there, Lieutenant. So they finally gave in to me, and I didn't have to. You know, as it was, we were already spending, each crewman would stay awake for 2 hours during the night on watch, and we would rotate the watch so that, and I took a turn with my tank crewman. So sometime during the night for 2 hours, I would be up with my binoculars, sticking up out of the turret, looking around, seeing if I could see anybody trying to crawl towards our perimeter. And I suppose the worst thing that happened to me, and it's taken me a long time to get over it, was a friend of mine from the basic school named Ted Christian was the executive officer of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. And Ted called me Ice Cream, because my last name Cone. And his nickname in the basic school was Warthog. He was a real homely-looking guy and had a rather strange nose. But he'd also been he'd also played fullback at West Virginia State and was pretty built like a fireplug. We ran into each other one day after they'd been there, after one night had been in the perimeter about 3-4 days, and I noticed that none of the men there were wearing their flak jackets and helmets. Well, by this time the rain had pretty much stopped, and now the sun was back out and the ground was drying up. So I went over to Ted and his company commander, and I said that, I've been here for a month, guys, and this is a dangerous place, and I see you men are walking around here with no helmets and flak jackets on. And Ted or his commanding officer or the battalion chaplain were sitting out there sunbathing with their shirts off, and I said, you guys are really asking for it. And Ted says, well, it doesn't seem that bad here. We've been here a few days. We've seen worse. And I said, Ted, buddy, listen to me. Put your flak jacket and helmet on, man. Trust me on this. He said, yeah, okay, well, whatever. Yeah, so I said, okay, I'll see you later. I wasn't gone from there but about 2 minutes, and I heard this whew, bang. And what had happened was the North Vietnamese had decided to fire a recoilless rifle airburst at us. And it went off right over Ted and his people. And I didn't know it at the time that that first round had killed him and mortally wounded his captain, and the battalion chaplain somehow came through unscathed. And then I saw all these people running up to where the explosion was, and I was thinking, oh no, you don't do that. These guys are stupid, because where one artillery shell or rocket comes in, there's going to be another one. And so, sure enough, a minute later, another one came in right in the same place and got all the guys that had all the looky lures and all the thrill seekers and everybody that had gone up to see what happened. they all got hit with the second round. And I still didn't know at this time that, that Ted had been killed. So I was at 4 o'clock, I had to walk up the hill to the briefing, and I see this this body, or this, you know, body laying under a blanket on a cot by the battalion aid station, and I just glanced over at the man's forearm, and I looked at his watch, and I said, that looks just like Ted Christian's watch. And I said, I called the corpsman, I said, who is that man? And he said, we don't know. He was down by the south gate where they took a direct hit, and his dog tags got blown off or something. We don't know who he is. And I said, well, pull the blanket back. Let me look at it. So he pulled the blanket back, and I was, there it was. It was Ted Christian, my good friend from basic school, just laying there like he was asleep. And so I told him who it was, then I went into the aid station, and the chaplain was there, and he says, don't worry, Lieutenant, I got to Ted in time. And I went off on the chaplain. I said, you got to him in time? Ted is dead, and you got to him in time? And then I realized, oh, geez, you know, this, I'm talking to the chaplain about this, the Catholic chaplain. So I turned around and left, and I went on up to the battalion CO's bunker, and he was standing out there. He's looking at me, and I guess he saw the expression on my face. He said, what's wrong, Jim? Or no, he said, what's wrong, Lieutenant? And I was having a hard time, you know, keeping my upper lip straight. I told him that Ted had been killed, and he turned around and he walked out, and we didn't have a meeting that night. He was so upset about it. So that briefing was canceled, and I don't know. Boy, I get emotional talking about this stuff. But anyway, that shortly after that, I think it was the next day, we got the word to our platoon was going to be rotated off of Contian. And the second platoon was coming up. The platoon leader was Bill Brignan, and the platoon sergeant was Gunnery Sergeant English. So they replaced us, and we pulled out in the morning. And as we were driving our tanks down the road towards, you know, heading south, we came to where the new bridge was. And that's when we learned that battalion of North Vietnamese had attacked that bridge that night, and the Marines there had managed to hold the perimeter and fight them off. And one Marine, Sergeant Foster, had been awarded the Medal of Honor for what he did there. He threw himself on a grenade that had been tossed into the command bunker, sacrificed his life to save the whole command group. So he was given the Medal of Honor. But anyway, that was a pretty big battle, too. I think I mentioned that in my book. Yes. Then we headed on south, and for a while, we had a little respite from it because we were at Charlie 2 in a nice, fantastically built bunker that had several layers of dirt that had been bulldozed over the top of the bunker, and Gunny Hopkins and I shared the same bunker, and we actually managed to get some ice, had some cold beer, some cold fruit, cold milk. It was nice living for a while.
What did it feel like? What did it feel like when you finally received your orders to leave Contien? Was it relief? Was it? Could you explain that to me?
A lot of relief, but you know you're not going home. I mean, this is just like, you know, in a 10-round fight, you made it through round one, so you're going to go sit down and catch your breath, and then you'll be back in it again later somewhere else. So we were just kind of glad to be out of Contien, but we weren't out of danger. So
sure.
We, you know, figured, well, this is just a little time out here, but we'll be back into it pretty soon.
Well, Mr. Cohn, I think that leaves us at a good place to take a break for the day.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. James Cone. Today is 25 July 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Cone is joining us again from his home in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Good morning, Mr. Cone.
Good morning.
When we left off yesterday, we had just finished the topic or discussion of the siege, the 40-day siege at Khon Tien. Can you pick up the story from there? What became of you after the siege?
You know, if I could, excuse me, I'd like to add a few things. So
oh, please do.
Out from yesterday, because about 75% of what I experienced over Vietnam was in that 40 days at Khon Tien.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a few things that I was thinking, excuse me, a few things I was thinking about last night that I neglected to mention and might clarify a little bit about the experience there.
Please do.
Okay. I think the first thing was why Khon Tien, and tactically, the Marines really had to hold that high ground because the high ground was really crucial to the overall strategy of McNamara and Westmoreland, which was to have these strong point, this strong point optical system working, and Khon Tien was a key observation post. Whoever held Khon Tien really could dominate the whole area, the whole DMZ area. So that was why there was a Khon Tien, and I didn't mention that before. Another thing was the tanks that we had there. And we had the M48A3 Patton tanks. And the difference between the M48A3 and other tanks of that genre were that we had diesel engines, and we had infrared capability. We had an improved vision ring. So I know we ran into Army units that had the old M48, A1s, and A2s who had gasoline-powered engines. We had diesel-powered engines, which made a really big difference as far as crew survivability. That was something I failed to mention yesterday.
Well, explain that to me a little bit, the gasoline versus the diesel engine.
Well, yes. As far as being fire hazard, if you get gasoline fumes anywhere around a flame, your tank's going to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
With the diesel engine that we had and the diesel fuel not being flammable like that, I mean, we even sometimes cooked our sea rations over an open flame inside the turret. So it was much safer, and a hit by an anti-tank rocket would not blow up the tank. It might put a hole in the side of your tank and throw hot metal around, but it's not necessarily going to destroy the tank. And I think that was really important for us, is to not have to worry about that. The other thing about the siege of Khon Tien is after about 30 days, the U.S. government declared that the siege was broken and that the North Vietnamese had suffered a horrendous defeat, thousands of casualties, and it was because we had had the attention of the media. A lot of the media pundits were comparing the siege of Khon Tien to that 1954 Battle of Dien Bien Phu,
mm-hmm.
where General Giap and the North Vietnamese, well, they didn't call them North Vietnamese, the Vietnamese had defeated the French. And so there was a lot of concern that we were going to be another Dien Bien Phu. But those that didn't know the facts, or those of us that knew the facts, I should say, weren't really concerned about that, because we, in addition to battalion of Marines we had at Khon Tien proper, I found out subsequently that we had two more Marine battalions within a half a kilometer of us. The 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines was south of us, and the 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines was east of us. So there was a full regiment of Marines there ready to come to our aid if the North Vietnamese decided they were going to overrun Khon Tien. And they could have made a good try, because they had thousands of their soldiers hidden in the jungles and in the DMZ area that had they wanted to, they could have tried to overrun us. That was a point I didn't make yesterday. And let's see. Oh, yeah. Well, our casualties, the official casualties were all over the place as far as what it cost us to hold that high ground. And I can tell you from what I've gathered that we had about 140 Marines killed and maybe 1,000 wounded during that battle. And I know Quezon got a lot of publicity and is kind of like, whenever they talk about the Vietnam War, they talk about Quezon. But I've talked to Marines who were in both places, and they said Con Tien was much worse. We were in a smaller area, and the amount of incoming that we took was more concentrated. And but anyway, that's neither here nor there. I just don't think that the reporting on the battle was as accurate as it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to say some things that might clear that up.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
And I think in your book on Con Tien certainly shows the intensity of that siege very, very well, for sure.
And I had, when I left Con Tien, I had suffered only two casualties. In my platoon, I had two men wounded from shrapnel, which I felt pretty fortunate considering what we had gone through for 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
Had two men, and they weren't really seriously wounded, but so I felt pretty good about that. And another thing you did yesterday, or when we last spoke, was you asked me how I felt about things, and I think sometimes we confuse. How do you feel about this? We start talking about what we're thinking,
mm-hmm.
instead of the emotions.
Sure,
involved.
Sure.
And I've got to tell you that we were all scared to death. And we just never knew when that one was going to come in on our heads and wipe us off the face of the earth. So there was that emotion going of fear,
mm-hmm.
and anxiety and anger. And we were really angry that our government had decided that we couldn't go up into the DMZ after those guys that were shooting at us. So I think those were the three prevalent emotions that we were feeling at the time.
Sure.
And the other thing I mentioned was how proud I was that, you know, in spite of being scared and in spite of the fear, everybody did their jobs. And they carried out their duties. And they don't give medals for that, and they don't give out recognition for that. But that seemed to be a common thread that I was very impressed with, was how everybody knew that at any second their life could be over. And they never held back and said, no, I can't take this anymore, I'm out of here. But there was nowhere to go. That's where we had to stay, and we had to just do what we had to do to survive, and it was a feeling I walked away with of immense pride. You know, all those Marines that I was there with, and wasn't only Marines. You know, the Navy corpsmen and the Army dudes driving around in their open, what we call dusters.
Mm-hmm.
If a mortar shell came around, those guys, they were toast, because they couldn't hide in the turret like we could.
Sure.
So those were some points that I wanted to make.
Sure, and I'm very glad that you mentioned those. You had mentioned yesterday as well that there was a sense of fatalism among yourself and among those who were with you, which...
Yeah, that's a, I think it's a survival technique.
Sure.
That the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines had the moniker of the Walking Dead. But my fatalistic attitude happened when I first reported to Alpha Company, 3rd Tanks in Dong Ha, just a few days before I went up to Con Tien, and I was reporting into the CP, what we call the hooch, you know, those plywood and corrugated tin structures that the CBs built. And above the doorway, they had the Alpha Company honor roll, and it was a white piece of wood and hand lettered in black paint. They had the names of all the Alpha Company tankers who had been killed in action in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking at those names, and about every third or fourth name was a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant. And I was beginning to think, you know what? This is not going to turn, this could very well not turn out good for me. And all of a sudden it just hit me that the odds of me surviving a year there were not good. And so you have a couple of choices. You can choose to be a worrywart and a nervous wreck and jump at every noise that you hear, or you can just accept that the chances are pretty good I'm not coming out of this alive, or if I come out of it, I'm going to come out of it wounded, and I hope that I'm not wounded too bad. And then you get busy about doing your job, and you don't think about it anymore, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't worry about, what if and that sort of thing, if you know what I'm talking about.
Sure,
you have to just accept that the odds are pretty good you're not going to make it out alive. You maybe have a 50-50 chance you're going to make it out alive, but at least you have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always that little hope that's floating around the back of your mind that hopefully I'll beat the odds. So there was that. I consider it like a survival technique that you just don't worry about those things. And then as a little story here, when I got down to my last week or two and I was out of the field, I was back in the company headquarters. I was the executive officer of Alpha Company at that time. And then I started worrying about getting zapped at the end of my tour. And I started having chest pains, indigestion, headaches, all sort of psychosomatic complaints. And I went to the base doctor, and he asked me, he said, Jim, are you worried about anything? I said, yeah, I'm worried about getting killed here my last week in country. Well, I have a pretty good hunch that once you get on the plane and get out of here, those chest pains will go away. And he was right.
I bet in some ways you were probably better off when you had accepted this attitude that you probably wouldn't make it out.
Yeah.
Okay, now, is there anything else you'd like to add about the seizure at Contien before we move on?
Well, one, I talked about the washout.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of glossed over that, but I was an eyewitness to that situation, and maybe I could talk about that?
Yes, please. As a matter of fact, I was hoping that you would go into more detail
on
that.
The night that the rain started, my tank and another tank were assigned to go out as part of the reaction force outside of the main perimeter. We spent the night at a little piece of high ground called Yankee Station, which is 500 meters or so south of Contien's perimeter wire. And we were just there in the event that something happened at Contien, and we would be there to go to try to wherever the breach in the wire was, we would go there. So nothing happened that night except that it started to rain, and then it rained harder and harder and harder. And also, as part of that assignment, we would have to escort the minesweep team clearing the road from Contien down to the artillery fire base at Charlie 2. We got on the road finally and headed south, and I noticed when we got to an area that had been called the Rocky Ford in years past, we saw like a lake of water that was backed up on the western side of the road, and water was shooting out of these corrugated tin culverts like a rooster tail, like you see these racing boats on the lake, where they shoot out a rooster tail. Well, that's the way the water was shooting out of the other side of the culvert. And I thought about maybe turning around at that point because I didn't know if the roadbed was safe, but I said, well, let's go. It looks like it'll hold us. And so it did. And no problem. We went across and continued on to Charlie 2. Excuse me. On the way back from Charlie 2, we got back to this same area again. about 20% of that roadway had crumbled, and that lake of water that was backed up was even larger, and I was really having some doubts about it, and you know, I jumped off the tank and went over, looked at it, looked back. I thought, geez, I don't know about this. So I asked one of my drivers. His name was his last name was Bors, Lance Corporal Bors. We called him Piggy. And I said, Piggy, what do you think? Can we go across? And he said, oh, yeah, sure, Lieutenant. We got to go now. Let's go. If we don't do it now, we're not going to be able to get across. So I jumped up in on the tank, got in the tank commander's cupola, reached back for my communications helmet, and I was looking in the eyes of those engineers and grunts that were on the back of my tank, and they were all, their eyes were like, you know, huge white eyes looking at me like, you're really not going across, are you, sir? And I thought, man, I don't know about this. And in that moment of hesitation, the whole thing just went, just the whole roadway just washed away.
Wow.
And the tragedy of all this is there were Marines on that, walking on that road when it washed across. And so I saw one man get washed into some trees, and a few of his buddies threw off their equipment and jumped into that water, which was just a raging torrent at this time. They jumped in there and pulled him to shore, and I believe they saved another guy for a little further downstream by doing the same thing. But then the word came back that one man was unaccounted for, and that was their corpsman, who had been washed away and obviously drowned. So there was nothing we could do at the time except turn around and go back to Charlie 2.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And we spent the next 5 days back at that artillery fire base called Charlie 2, waiting for the rain to stop. And then one morning, the captain, my company commander, came out with the XO of the battalion and said, you guys are going back to Contiem. They had a tank retriever with them, which was going to be used to pull out some of the other tanks that had been stuck in the mud from Gunning English's platoon. So I said, okay, sir. So we got all our stuff together, and as we headed north, I knew that the road hadn't been swept and for mines. And I told my driver to stay off the road and just go parallel. And the other tank followed me, and so did the retriever. The only one foolish enough to be going down the road was the captain in his Jeep. And I was waiting at any second to see a big boom and see that Jeep go flying through the air. But by some miracle, they didn't hit a mine. And I wasn't, you know, you had to understand the relationship. I didn't have a good relationship with my CO. He'd been kind of a jerk to me, and I didn't like the man, and I'm not going to mention him by name. And so I kind of had a, well, screw you attitude. You know, if you're going to be arrogant with me, you know, you can face the consequences of your own arrogance.
Sure.
So he headed on up the road. We got to the washout, which was now dry as far as depth of water. It was only maybe a couple feet now. And we, to make a long story short, we hit a mine. The other tank that was with us went in a different direction. They hit a mine, and we had two disabled tanks. And it was getting late in the afternoon. I had inexperienced crewmen with me, and I had only been in charge of the platoon about 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we ended up trying to short track the tanks so that they could be towed back. But every time we would get out there and start working, a sniper would open up on us. And it was, and we would fire back with our machine guns, and then we wouldn't get any sniper fire, and then we'd start working, and then the sniper would start pinging away at us again. By the time that the captain and his tank retriever got back to us, towing one of the stuck tanks, by the way, that they pulled out of the mud, here we were. It's getting dark. Both tanks are not, still hadn't had them. Short track means that you bypass the damaged road wheels and you hook up the track, and so you kind of limp out with just kind of can move, but you're handicapped in trying to move. So, but we weren't able to short track the tank, so he was in a predicament of what do we do now? He called back to the rear and he said, "Get out of there. There's a B-52 strike due imminently in that area. So get your tankers out of there and leave the tanks." So we had to abandon our tanks, take away the firing pins and dismantle the radios and put a padlock on the turrets and hope that the North Vietnamese didn't mess with the tanks until they could be retrieved the next day. And I was sent off on foot with my two tank crews, and we spent the night with some infantry in some muddy foxholes. I shared a foxhole with a grunt who had nightmares all night long, tossed and turned and groaned and moaned. It was just awful. I didn't get any sleep at all that night, and plus I was up to my knees in mud and water, freezing cold mud and water. And it was just a really bad night. We did manage to get back up to Con Tien the next morning. And that's when we were waiting for a helicopter ride back to company headquarters. We got some incoming, and that's when I lost my two crewmen, Private Manchego and Boers. They got hit by it. We were at the helicopter LZ and took some incoming, and both of them got shrapnel wounds. And so they had to be medevaced. And then I figured the only way I was going to get out of there was to, they had some dead Marines on stretchers covered with ponchos by the landing zone there, the helicopter landing zone. And I thought, well, what I had noticed is if you carried a stretcher to the door, the side door of the helicopter, and pushed it in, then you could jump in afterwards and you could get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I, myself and another Marine, waited till the next helicopter came in, landed. We picked up a dead Marine on a stretcher, and we carried him over to the helicopter, and the door gunner said, "We're not taking any dead Marines, we only want the wounded." And I looked at him, I was a little crazy by this time. I said, "You're taking this guy." And I think he could tell by the look in my eye that he was taking him. And I pushed him in there on the floor, and I jumped in, and I pulled that other Marine in with me that was waiting for a ride out. And we took off, and that's how I got back to Dong Ha. Door gunner was kind of miffed and wouldn't make eye contact with me. But, you know, after all we'd gone through and no sleep, I'll admit I was just a little bit cranky.
I can certainly understand that.
Yeah, so that's the story of the washout. And it was repaired within 2 weeks, and they put a bridge over that washout area that would handle tanks and any kind of vehicles. The night of September 13th, 14th, I believe it was, the North Vietnamese did attack the unit of Marines that was defending the bridge. They knew that it was important to keep that supply route open, but those Marines were able to hold on to the bridge and not let it get captured or destroyed.
Now,
I think that was pretty much the end of the siege.
Okay. Were there Marines permanently stationed there at the bridge to hold it?
There were, yes.
Okay.
In fact, I guess we'll get to this later, but I ended up coming back a couple months later, and my tanks were part of the detachment of Marines that guarded the bridge.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, what about after the siege? You make your way to Dong Ha. How long were you in Dong Ha?
Well, actually, we only went as far south as Charlie 2.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, we went as far south as Charlie 2, and we it was kind of like an R&R for us, and in that we any incoming was very infrequent. We had gone that whole 40 days without any showers. So here was our chance to get some showers and use soap and wash our clothes and eat some hot food. You know, we'd gone 40 days without any of those luxuries.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and actually not have to use a latrine at night because of fear of incoming, we could actually use one in daylight. So it was definitely a breather for us. But after 30 days there, we got the word to go back up to the washout. And then we had three tank platoons in the company, so we were taking turns every 30 days of rotating between those three locations. Charlie 2, the washout, and Contian. We'd spend 30 days at one place, move up, and, you know, musical chairs type of thing.
Sure. If you could, Mr. Cohn, if you could you describe for me the base there at Charlie 2? From a physical standpoint,
Charlie
what did it look like?
Okay, Charlie 2 was primarily an artillery fire base.
Okay.
And the because of this die marker operation, which was the strong point obstacle system with all of these mutually supporting fire bases, they had come in and put bunkers in that were called die marker bunkers that were put in by Marine engineers, and they had 12 by 12 beams. They had they had stairs, electrical light, you know, battery-powered lights. It was, and they even had places along the walls, kind of like for bunk beds, so you could just throw out your inflatable rubber lady there, whatever you call them, and your mattress, and put them down, and it was clean, it was dry, it was safe. They had a lot of protection overhead, and probably only like 152-millimeter artillery shell is about the only thing that a direct hit with that might penetrate, but anything else wouldn't penetrate. So you were relatively safe in those die marker bunkers.
Okay.
And that's what they were trying to do at Contien, but because of the rain and the mud and the harassment by the North Vietnamese up in the DMZ, they weren't able to get those die marker bunkers built until later that spring. But Charlie 2 was actually, and they even had a mess tent there that you could go get hot food.
So
we were a couple miles south of Contien.
Okay. So what things were you doing here? You say you were at Charlie 2 for 30 days, is that correct?
Yeah, mainly just tanks need daily preventive maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't get that, they break down. So we had been pretty slack about that sort of thing when we were taking incoming at Contien, and a lot of that preventive maintenance, you know, is it more important to grease up your road wheels or stay alive? So, of course, all the maintenance stuff got put on the back shelf. And so we got to Charlie 2. We spent a lot of time just kind of, you know, getting our sensibilities back and relaxing and working on our tanks. Alpha Company would send out their maintenance men, and they would work on our tank radios and anything else that wasn't up to par.
What sort of things did you do here for relaxation or recuperation?
Oh, mainly played cards. Cards, chess, checkers, write letters.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't write any letters home, so that was out for me.
Right.
But I had a man in my platoon, Lance Corporal Travail, who was a Canadian citizen, had spent 2 years in the Canadian Army and had a little experience. He'd been a tanker in the Canadian Army and had also had a couple of years of college under his belt. Travail was a genius. And when we'd pull into a location like that, his favorite thing was to take his chessboard over to another unit, an artillery unit or infantry unit, and find out who the officers were and challenge them to a game of chess. He never lost.
Really?
He never lost. I played a little chess myself. I wouldn't even take him on. He was so good. And as a little aside, while we were there at Charlie 2, Travail worked on a couple of our tank radios. He did work that they do back in Barstow, California. He did some work on the radios, and subsequently an inspector came out from battalion headquarters, and I got a commendation for my outstanding tank radios, thanks to Travail. he was something else. So that's how we passed the time.
Sure.
Did some gambling. Yeah, we gambled. Gambled on cards, poker, whatever.
Well, you spent this time here at Charlie 2, and then you go back to the bridge, I believe you said.
It's still called the Washout Bridge.
The Washout Bridge. What was it like? You knew that you had to go back. What was it like to leave the relative comforts at Charlie 2 to go back to the Washout Bridge?
Well, we were, now we're on potential combat, but we knew there'd been a big battle there the month before. So we were pulling watches at night, and they had us doing something really stupid, though. So you just have to follow orders. And the infantry captain wanted us periodically through the night to put a canister round, which is like a giant shotgun shell, put a canister round in the chamber and just blast away in case any sappers were trying to sneak up on our position. We didn't have the wire. We didn't have the minefields. We had a lot of trees around there, so it would have been easy to have a unit sneak up to us and try to overrun us. Instead of having a 5-tank platoon there, they gave us 3 more tanks. So we had 8 tanks at that location. Because the higher-ups, the brass, were pretty concerned that the North Vietnamese would try again to destroy that bridge and cut off our supply route to Cantien. What I understand is that the incoming and the bombardment that we had been taking in September and early October, by this time, which was November and early December, all of that had slacked off. That the siege was broken. So the guys that went up there subsequently did not face what we faced during the siege. I went back up. Remember, I went back up. My turn to rotate was the end of December of 67. And my first night there was Christmas Eve. And about midnight on Christmas Eve, the military has these pop-up flares. They're an aluminum tube about a foot, 16 inches long. You take the cap off the top, you put it on the bottom, and you bang it on something, and it fires a flare up in the air. And you have red flares, green flares, white, all these kind of colored flares. To signal, maybe to signal aircraft or whatever. And I noticed I kept hearing some pop whoosh sounds around our perimeter there at Cantien, and red and green and white flares were shooting up. And then I looked out towards Jo Lynn down the trace, and their base had red, green, and white flares popping up. And I looked back at Cam Lo, and I could see back to Dong Han. I could see Charlie 2. Every one of our fire bases had guys popping those flares. Well, this is a serious breach of security. You just don't fire a flare like that unless you've cleared it all the way up to the President of the United States. It's a serious thing. And all these Marines just broke loose on Christmas Eve. It was really something to see. And of course you had your what we call the lifers, the senior NCOs and the officers running around trying to and yelling over the radio, stop this, stop that, don't do this, we'll court-martial you, da-da-da-da-da. It didn't faze them at all. If anything, they fired up even more flares. That was pretty memorable.
Well, it was the Christmas season, and the colors were right.
And I remember they brought in a Christmas dinner for us, turkey and mashed potatoes and stuff like that. Well, what they didn't know was that we'd all been on a sea ration diet for so long that when we got that rich food, it just tore us up. Mm-hmm. And every one of us was running to the bathroom. Yeah. But that was... it was different. When we went back to Cantien and into the new year, January, it was just so much calmer, and I was just not worrying every second about something blowing me up. It was a different experience. The ground was a little harder, so occasionally we were still going out to protect the infantry and engineers on the road mine sweeps, and occasionally we'd go outside the perimeter. If a unit stepped into something, maybe ran into an ambush or something, we'd go out there and be the reaction force. The ground was still pretty soggy. There were places we couldn't go because we knew we would get stuck, and then that would make a little problem into a major problem.
Sure.
So they were a little reluctant to use us, and I wasn't disappointed at that because I didn't want to have to go through getting stuck in the mud. I know what a nightmare that can be for a tanker.
Sure, being exposed when you're trying to get out as well.
Yeah.
Well, this takes us into January of 1968, and obviously you know what's coming next here.
You're right.
What did the beginning of the Tet Offensive mean to you? Were you still at Contien?
I was still at Contien.
Okay.
And
explain to me what happened there.
Hardly anything.
Okay.
It was like it was very strange. As we heard about the attacks all over the country, and we were on ultra high alert, but nothing happened to us at Contien.
Do you think that was
quiet for us?
Excuse me. Do you think that was due in part to the fact there was so much activity there in that area before that perhaps the NVA had spent themselves, or were they just bypassed Contien and focused more on the more heavily populated centers?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think they wanted to have us focus on these outlying areas,
mm-hmm.
these fire bases and Quezon and other places like that. When they really wanted us not to be thinking about those highly populated areas where they were going to attack. I believe that was what it was.
Okay.
So we'd served their purpose. By the time Tet rolled around, they had no more need for us.
Mm-hmm. It was easy to bypass you from that,
yes.
at that point on then. So you really saw no action during the offensive?
Nothing more than we had seen previously.
Okay. Interesting. Well, did you get a sense of what the... You said you heard about the attacks all over the rest of the country. Did you get a sense of the size, the scale of the Tet Offensive while you were up there at Contien?
No, I didn't. I really didn't know of the extent of it, except that we had been... The word came down to us that North Vietnamese MiGs were headed south,
mm-hmm.
and that they were going to attack positions south of the DMZ, and so we had better be ready that a major offensive was headed our way. And we looked, I remember, I have a cupola-mounted 50 caliber machine gun that fires, one box of ammunition, 50 rounds, and then you have to open another box, scrape your knuckles on the inside of the top of the cupola hatch trying to reload the 50 caliber. And I was looking at, I didn't have a high draw, any way electrical of rotating that machine gun. I had to crank it, one handle would crank it up and down, and one would crank it left and right, traverse left and right. And I said, you know what? There is no way that I would ever be able to shoot down a jet coming at me. I mean, it would be impossible. Not only that, if you didn't have your timing exactly right on the solenoid, you might get off three rounds, and then you have to crank the charger handle manually, get off two or three more rounds, crank the it was a worthless weapon. Subsequently, they improved that. And the new Abrams tanks, of course, has a magnificent cupola-mounted machine gun, but ours was just really poorly designed and impractical and worthless in a situation like that. And we all kind of looked at each other like, I wonder if we put a canister round in the cannon and aimed it as high as we could, maybe we could shoot at it like a shotgun. But no, thankfully, we never saw any jets and we never saw any tanks coming our way, and that was just a rumor that never materialized.
Sure. Well, tell me about, and this is roughly the same time, up in that area, south of the DMZ, about Operation Kentucky. Were you part of Operation Kentucky?
Yes, it was.
Okay, could you explain the purpose of that and your role in it?
Okay. I went up. Okay, first of all, I made first lieutenant in February of 68.
Okay.
Then we had rotated back, in the end of, sometime in February, rotated off of Contien. We went back to Charlie 2 again. And then in March, the end of March of 68, I was told to get everybody loaded up and get ready because you're going up to Contien to stay. So in March of 68, we went back up, and this was going to be our permanent home. It was going to be Contien, and the rains had pretty much stopped. The ground was firm, so we were ready to go on operations or do whatever we needed to do to support the infantry that was there. But they really didn't utilize us, Kelly, much other than just protection for road sweeps, and sometimes we would go out on an operation where we would go on a search and destroy operation, and we would accompany the infantry, but we didn't really make any contact. That changed in April of 68 when, I'm trying to think of the unit that I was with, but they did come across a unit of large unit of North Vietnamese that were coming across the trace and headed south, and they had trapped them in Leatherneck Square so that they weren't able to keep going south. They couldn't go east or west, and they couldn't go back across the trace, and then the whole area was under the command of the 9th Marines, and the 9th Marines brought in, they surrounded them with about three or four battalions. So they had more than a regiment of Marines surrounding this unit, and pretty big battles happened. I had gone on R&R, and
where had you gone for R&R?
I went to Hawaii on R&R. Yeah, I kept getting bumped off the R&R list, and finally a position on a plane came up for Hawaii, and I said, I'll take it, because I'd been wanting to go to Australia, but I, for some reason, and I don't know how the politics worked, I kept getting bumped. So I came back and to find out that my platoon, while I was gone, had been a reaction force that went out and got involved in some pretty serious fighting southeast of Contien. None of the tankers were casualties, and they didn't lose any tanks, but there was an area south of southeast of Contien called Phu Oc, P-H-U-O-C, two words, and the unit that had gone in there had been ambushed and took some pretty serious casualties. My tanks were part of the reaction force that went in there and helped rescue those that were wounded and pull out those killed. But as the envelopment of that North Vietnamese unit progressed, and they kept pushing, the North Vietnamese were retreating across the trace. And it, as I described before, it was bulldozed flat, and you could see it was just like a golf course fairway. And groups of the North Vietnamese that were trapped were trying to break out, and they were in the afternoon, in full daylight, trying to run across that 600-meter bulldozed clear trace. And the tankers at Contien that were sitting up on OP3 and the grunts with their recoilless rifles and the helicopter gunships and the people at Jo Lynn, it was a turkey shoot. It was a massacre. They'll never, hardly any of those trapped North Vietnamese that tried to run back north, hardly any of them made it alive across there. But I missed that. I didn't see it. All I heard was stories about it. And that was one of the big actions in our area during Kentucky. In July, Operation Thor, that was next. And the reason for Operation Thor was that our 3rd Marine Amphibious Force, the headquarters, decided that they'd had enough of this area up in the southern DMZ that we weren't allowed to go in after the North Vietnamese. So they decided that they were going to go after them. And it started the 1st of July with a really heavy bombardment from air, sea, and our own artillery. They pulled a unit of 8-inch guns into Con Dien, and they were firing over our heads. And you don't think that kept you awake all night. Big 8-inch guns firing over Con Dien up into the demilitarized zone, and even firing over the Ben Hai River up into North Vietnam. That went on for several days, and when we looked out there, just the whole area was just blanketed with smoke and dust. You could hardly see what was going on, but you knew that something pretty serious was going on up there. Then we went out with the infantry, the whole 9th Marine Regiment, 1st Battalion, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Battalion. My platoon from Con Dien was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, and we were to rotate around Con Dien in like a wagon wheel formation with the 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines on our left, and we were the battalion that was closest to Con Dien. And then the other battalion, the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, was to come up from Cam Lo up through Leatherneck Square, and we were all supposed to meet at the trace. So we started that operation around July 5th, and that was the first time I had really been on an operation where tank infantry coordination was required, and even though I'd been in country about 10 months and had that platoon for about 8 months, this was a new experience for me. We didn't hardly contact any of the enemy up there. It was pretty much a piece of cake until 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, which was the outside battalion on the sweep going around like a wagon wheel, they actually went up into the southern part of the demilitarized zone, and that's where they made contact. And that was probably the time I came the closest to not making it home. I was in my tank, sitting up, looking around with my torso sticking up out of the tank commander's cupola, and for some reason I decided, you know, I need a drink of water, and I dropped down into the tank turret for just a second to grab my canteen cup, and an artillery shell landed right next to the tank. If I had been standing up 2 seconds longer, I wouldn't be here right now. So that was probably the closest call I ever had. There was another I didn't even mention the time I got wounded. That was a very close call.
No, you didn't. I wanted to talk to you about that as well. Yeah.
So let me finish this Operation Thor. So,
sure.
Tell you what. Let's come back to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Where I got wounded was in May of 68. I had a new platoon sergeant, and that was my 4th platoon sergeant that I'd gone through. And altogether, I went through 5 platoon sergeants during my 10 months because of personal reasons, being wounded. One of them had a nervous breakdown. There were different reasons, but he was my, 4th platoon sergeant. So I had him out in my tank. We were sitting up. He was sitting up in the loader's hatch, and I was in the tank commander's cupola, and we were watching an airstrike being run out in Leatherneck Square. And I had my binoculars up to my face. I was looking, and the gunny was on my right, and I guess a forward observer spotted us. It was something that I would never have done months earlier because, you know, I would have been worried about that. But we hadn't taken any incoming for 2 or 3 weeks up there, Con Dien. I thought, you know, well, they're paying attention somewhere else. They're not even looking at us anymore. Well, I was wrong. And an FO spotted us, and the first, like I said, you don't ever hear the first mortar shell if you have all this noise going around of trucks and tanks and helicopters and stuff. You don't hear it. So the first shell landed right next to the tank on Gunny Thomason's side, and he took most of the shrapnel, and I got one piece in the back of my wrist. And I'm thinking, had I not had my binoculars up to my face, that shrapnel probably would have hit me in the eye or the face. But anyway, it hit me in the hand, and that's how I got wounded. I wasn't paying too much attention myself. I really had to get the gunny down inside the turret and start applying direct pressure, because he was, you know, he was pretty well riddled, and he was shooting blood everywhere. So I managed to get all of his bleeding stopped, and then we, some of the tankers ran out, so we got him to the aid station, and he's all right. He got medevaced out. I was not considered serious enough to be medevaced. I went into the aid station, and the Navy doctor there started probing around. He said, you know, Lieutenant, if I could do a lot of damage, nerve damage to your hand if I don't do this right. It might be better to just leave the shrapnel in there. So he did, and that was the end of that.
Do you still have the shrapnel?
So I stayed there at Contien. I didn't go anywhere. My hand swelled up twice its size and turned purple, but that was the only effect I had from that.
Do you still have the shrapnel in your hand?
No, I don't. About 20 years later, I was out. We had this stuff on the side of our house called pampas grass, P-A-M-P-A-S
yes.
grass, and it's a huge thing. And I took a machete, and I was trying to chop it down. And by the end of a couple hours of that, my hand, I couldn't move my wrist, my hand. it was extremely painful, and I couldn't hold a cup, I couldn't hold a pen or anything. So I went to the doctor, and he said that shrapnel had worked its way into the base of the thumb joint, and he would recommend operating on it. So I went to one of the best, I didn't go to the VA, I went to a physician there in California who was known for his hand surgery. He was known all over the world as an expert, and he opened up that joint, took the shrapnel out. I still have that piece of shrapnel as a little war souvenir. It's about the size, you know what a pellet looks like that you fire out of a pellet gun?
Sure.
Yeah, well, that's about the size of what it was. It's interesting, I carried that around on my wrist all these years, and it never bothered me until that one day. So I did have the shrapnel removed.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Operation Thor. You said
okay.
You want to get back to that.
That was my last operation, and I was, after we got done with the wagon wheel sweep, and I found out subsequently that we had uncovered, there were also bulldozers with us that I didn't know about that were following in trace of us. When the infantry would come across a bunker that had supplies in it or anything like that, the bulldozers would, the engineers would set charges, detonate it, blow it up, and then the bulldozers would come in and level it. And it was like a scorched earth policy. I think 3rd MAF decided they'd had enough of what General Japp and his North Vietnamese were doing to our grand plan to put an anti-infiltration barrier across the southern part of the DMZ, and they were going to make sure that this was a significant setback for the North Vietnamese, and it was, because they destroyed hundreds of supply caches, ammunition, food, things like that, and just basically leveled the place out there. And but we continued our operation south into Leatherneck Square, and we never made any contact. It was a deal where the infantry would go from point A to point B. We would go along with them. They'd see a tree line and say, fire a few rounds in there. We'd fire a few rounds into the tree line, and then they would check it out, and there'd be nothing there. So nothing was really going on, except that it was so blasted hot. It was like 120 degrees in the middle of the summer. And I remember there were times when I was thinking, you know, I've been out here 10 months, and usually for an officer like that, you'd expect to be out in the field for 6 months. I was out there 10 months, and I was beginning to feel kind of unappreciated. I think the only people that appreciated me were the guys in my platoon, because I was pretty experienced, and I wasn't about to do something stupid to get them hurt, so they didn't want me to go away and get a brand new green lieutenant in there. One day we were just kind of, we'd stopped for a water break, and a helicopter landed nearby, and this second lieutenant walked up to me and said, "Are you Lieutenant Cone?" I said, "Yeah, so what?" Said, "Well, I'm your replacement. I'm Frank Blakemore, and you're supposed to get on this helicopter and leave, and go back to Dong Ha." And I think within 2 minutes, I grabbed everything that was important to me, said goodbye to all my tank commanders, and jumped on that helicopter.
Just like that. You had no idea it was coming.
Huh?
You had no idea this was coming?
Had no idea. Had no idea at all.
What day was this? Do you remember?
This was on my birthday, too, July 15th. Best birthday present I ever had.
Incredible. That is truly incredible.
And when I got back to Dong Ha, got off the helicopter, got a jeep ride to Alpha Company headquarters. The captain said, "Lieutenant, I'm making you the executive officer of the company. I was monitoring your radio communications, and I really liked the way you directed your tanks, so you're going to be my XO." So that's what I did the rest of the time I was in Dong Ha. I was the executive officer.
So what was that, about 2 months, I guess?
About 2 months, yeah.
What were your duties here as XO?
Not much. Walk around the tank ramp and make sure that nobody was doing anything that was going to get them hurt. Do some paperwork. Monitor, go down to the radio shack and monitor communications with the other units that were reporting into the company. Occasionally the captain would say, "I want you to make sure everybody gets the word on this and this," and I would make sure that the information got disseminated to the other units. And the closer I got to my going home date, the less and less I left the company area.
Mm-hmm.
We would go over to the 9th Motor Transport Battalion, where they had a really good kitchen, and yeah, I ate 3 good meals a day. When I went to Vietnam, I probably weighed close to 190 pounds. I was less than 160 by the time I got back to Dong Ha. So I was a frequent visitor over at the 9th Motor Transport kitchen, trying to put some of that weight back on. But that was very much it. There was one operation that came up when I had about 2 or 3 days left to go. It was a joint Marine Corps South Vietnamese Army operation. It was called Lam Son 250, L-A-M and then S-O-N, two words, 250. And 2 platoons of Marine tanks were going to escort an Arvin, that's a South Vietnamese, up to an area above Jo Linh near the ocean, because they had been intelligence that the North Vietnamese were, a large unit of North Vietnamese were camped up there. And I missed this operation, but they... The tankers, those 2 tank platoons, were credited with over 200 North Vietnamese KIAs. And the South Vietnamese Army troops that rode on the bank of our tanks, our guys were pretty impressed with their bravery. You know, the South Vietnamese Army kind of gets a bad rap, that they really didn't want to fight for their country, and it was only the elite units like the Marines and the Rangers and those that were really ready to fight and die. Well, not these guys. These guys were very brave and very good. And the mission, Lam Son 250, was a smashing success. They totally destroyed that North Vietnamese battalion, and they ran back across the river and weren't heard from for a long time. That was a very good joint Marine Corps South Vietnamese Army operation. I missed that. Every one of the tankers that was there, when they got back into Dong Ha, a South Vietnamese general had those tankers lined up and personally awarded each one of them Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. But I, you know, I was not part of that. I just decided, you know, I just needed to be on the plane and going home.
Sure, sure. So
that was that. This is, I think, this pretty much covers what happened to me and what I did over in Vietnam.
Well, you mentioned the Vietnamese. I've got two questions here. They're large questions, I think. Offer me your impressions of, first, the South Vietnamese military capabilities, both the military, civilians. What were your impressions of the South Vietnamese?
Okay. I'm going to have to clear my throat. Just hang
sure.
A sec. Hello. Okay. Yeah, it was a surprise to me that when I first reported in country, the Vietnamese civilians appeared to be just tolerating us. I thought we would be treated like, you know, we're here to save their culture and their lives, literally, and it's kind of like they were just putting up with us, tolerating us. That was my first impression. I didn't really have much contact with the South Vietnamese Army at all. I can't really tell you about the military because I just really had almost no contact with them, except I can tell you that that time that we were getting our tanks over to the Qua Viet to get them on the Mike boats so they could go up the Qua Viet for that Lamson 250 operation, I got the strangest feeling walking around the South Vietnamese civilians there, because I saw these hard-looking young men in civilian clothes, and they were not friendly. They looked at me like they would like to come over and stick a knife in me, and I'm pretty sure that they were Viet Cong infiltrators who were, no one wanted to give them up because it'd be a death sentence for them if they told somebody that, hey, these people aren't from here, they're from, you know, they're not on our side. The only other thing that I can tell you was we would go into these villes to do some shopping, get some what we call Ho Chi Minh sandals, which were these tires made out of automobile tires with the inner tube strap, a piece of inner tube that they would secure to the sandal to make, you know, that you put between your two toes to hold your sandals on. Call those Ho Chi Minh sandals, and we'd get candles. If we could, we would buy some beer, and once in a while we'd get some alcohol. As far as our any hanky-panky or anything with the South Vietnamese women there, my experience was they wanted nothing to do with us where we were, and there'd be some papasan, we call him, some guy with a beard, old man, would be eyeballing the girls. And kind of the look was, don't talk to those Marines, don't have anything to do with those Marines, and you stay out of sight till they're gone. One interesting experience I did have is, as I went into the bill there at Cam Lo, when I was a Charlie 2, to get a haircut. And but I took my insignia off, and I made sure I said, you know, don't call me Lieutenant. My name's Jim.
Okay.
But I guess there was something that they sensed or picked up. They could tell that I wasn't just Jim, Lance Corporal Jim, you know, that I was the platoon leader. I would sit down and I would have my 45. I always carried a 45 in a shoulder holster. I always had that 45, my hand on that 45. My antenna were up. I'd heard too many stories, and the guy would put the sheet over me and give me a pretty good haircut, crack my neck and all that. So I went back again in another month or so, got another haircut, same thing, no problem. And then during Tet of 68, night that the Camlo District Headquarters was attacked, the river that ran by there, the Camlo River, and they had a Marine Corps installation down the road called Charlie 3,
mm-hmm.
which was south of Charlie 2 by several miles. And Charlie 3 Marines had their sniper, had a sniper team watching the bridge at night, and they picked up through their sniper scopes some frogmen swimming towards the bridge, pushing some sort of it's like some stuff wrapped in and floating in front of them as they swam towards the bridge. Well, the snipers opened up with their starlight scopes and picked them off. And when they pulled the bodies up on the bank, guess what? One of those frogmen was the barber that had been cutting my hair.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And all of these times that you'd been there.
What's that?
And all of the times that you had been there for him
he
to cut your
hair. Two or three times. And was smiling and showing me his teeth and very friendly. And guy was a Viet Cong frogman.
Wow. Have you had a chance to, I'm sure you have, had a chance to reflect on that since you've come back over the years?
Well, yeah, it was, it's just, you just have to shake your head at what we had gotten ourselves into, what we had gotten ourselves into as a country. You know, the way the parameters that we set for ourselves as far as how far we could go north up into across the DMZ, and the fact that we couldn't go into Cambodia and we couldn't go into Laos, and if we did, it was going to create a huge uproar in this country. In fact, it did around 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Great student protest. The parameters that we set for ourselves and how we decided we were going to wage this war was not winnable. But that's, you know, this is looking back on it years later. It was a no-win situation. There's no way we could walk out of there with a win. And until Nixon got really tough and started bringing the B-52s into Hanoi and got the North Vietnamese to the peace table, I don't want to say that we sacrificed a lot of lives for nothing. I mean, we were well-intentioned. We thought we were doing the right thing, and we thought that the strategy and tactics that we were employing were going to lead to victory. But when I think about the things that I experienced like that with the friendly town barber being a Viet Cong sapper, and the other civilians knew it, but nobody would come forward and finger him and say, you need to get this guy out of here. I don't know how you can win a war against people like that.
Very interesting. Well, my other big question had to do with the other side, the enemy. What were your impressions of the, mostly, of course, you faced NVA.
Yeah.
Did you encounter other VC in combat?
You know, we might have. Me personally, I believe that what we encountered were NVA hardcore units. It's possible there were some Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
The unit that attacked the Camlo District Headquarters was made up of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army. We had a lot of respect for them as warriors. They were tough, would fight to the death, wouldn't surrender unless they were incapacitated and unable to fight back, maybe wounded. Really, you know, just hardcore indoctrination. They were pretty, sadistic to any of our side that got captured alive. And were we afraid of them? No. Did we think we could defeat them? Yes. Did we respect them? Yes, we respected them as a worthy enemy, and determined. They were quite the adversary for us, and we got outsmarted sometimes by them because they had a lot of time to figure out what we were doing. We tended to fall into patterns, and we would do things repeatedly the same way. And so they would see that as a weakness they could exploit, and they often did exploit that weakness of us. But they would hang in there if they were surrounded and outgunned. They would not just say, all right, you got us, we quit. They wouldn't quit. And that was that indoctrination, I believe, that indoctrination that they received from early on. And they did the same things that we did. I mean, the loyalty that you have for your comrades is so powerful. And we had that same loyalty amongst us Marines, and I'm sure soldiers and sailors did the same thing. You really fight and die for the guy on either side of you and behind you. It's not this great cause. I think that the difference between us and our North Vietnamese enemy is that not only were they fighting for each other, but they totally believed that their cause was worth dying for. We didn't think that our cause was worth dying for, but the men on either side of us, they were worth fighting for, if you can understand what I'm trying
to say. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. And so for them, surrender was not an option. Often it was fight to the death, and I think we experienced some of that in World War II with the Japanese, that for different reasons, but to try to fight an enemy that's not going to surrender, even if they run out of ammunition, they're going to hang in there. That's a pretty tough group to fight.
Well, tell me about receiving your orders to go home then in September.
Okay. I had put in... Every time they would hand us the dream sheet, we call it a dream sheet because you put down where you want to have your duty stations, 1, 2, 3. And I always wanted to go back to the West Coast somewhere because I was from the West Coast. So, of course, my duty station was going to be Camp Lejeune, North Carolina on the East Coast. I got back to Camp Lejeune and was assigned to 2nd Tank Battalion, 2nd Marine Division. Within 2 or 3 months there, an opening came up with Charlie Company, 2nd Tank Battalion, and I was offered the job as the company commander. So I was the first lieutenant company commander, and all the other company commanders were captains.
Why were you chosen as junior rank?
Could be my combat experience, could be that... We went to some training and loaded up all the battalion tanks on flat cars and went to an army, I think it was Fort Stewart, Georgia. And we went down there for some live fire gunnery. And when we got to the base there where they put us, there was no recreation for them, for the men. They had no library, no pool tables, no ping pong, no nothing for them to do, at the end of the day. So I was kind of a fifth wheel staff officer. I really didn't have too much responsibility for anything. So I went out with my NCO, and we went all over the base, and we connected with the library. We went to the base recreation officer. So as a result of my efforts, these trucks pulled up, and they started unloading ping pong tables and pool tables and bringing in books for the guys to read and things like that. And I think some people were impressed that I was looking after the men and their morale. So what I heard was some of the senior NCOs went to the colonel and said, this Lieutenant Cone is good people. He looks after his troops. File that away for future reference. So I think that helped. So the next time they had a company commander opening, I was given the job. I wasn't the only first lieutenant, by the way. There was a first lieutenant, Marty Steele, who had Alpha Company. And Marty was the youngest, I believe was the youngest company commander in the Marine Corps. He was only 22 years old. you prior enlisted, served as a Lance Corporal in Vietnam in 1965, came back, finished college, went to OCS, and now he was a first lieutenant. Marty would go on to become a lieutenant general and was quite influential in the Marine Corps having Abrams tanks. But back in those days, I was about 26 or 27. He was 22. He was kind of like my little brother. And I called him Marty, and he called me Jimmy. And I'm in the Vietnam Tankers Association. So the first time we had a board of directors meeting, General Steele walks in. He walks over to me and says, "Jimmy, how are you doing?" I said, "Marty, how are you?" We gave each other man hugs, and everyone in the room was saying, "Can you imagine this? Here's a general giving this guy a hug." Yeah. So anyway, that was pretty much the experience. I had the company of heavy tanks. The Marine Corps doesn't have those M103 A2s anymore. They had a 120-millimeter gun. They weighed 62 tons. They had a five-man crew. And they were just considered too heavy for being able to negotiate around, you know, terrain that we thought we might be going into. So the Marine Corps got rid of those, and now they have the Abrams tanks, which are just as heavy and have a 120-millimeter gun.
Now, you came back to the United States in 1968.
Right.
The protests, of course, are raging. The impression of the American soldier returning from Vietnam in many people's eyes in the United States was not a positive. They were not looked at in a positive way. What were your experiences upon coming back to the U.S. in regards to the war protests, et cetera?
Yeah. When I got on the plane in Okinawa, when I was in Da Nang, waiting for my flight out on Flying Tiger Airlines, I was standing with a bunch of new boot Marines that had just come in country, and they heard a rocket coming in. The enemy would occasionally fire rockets towards the airbase, and I knew from my experience that that thing was going to land a mile away. I wasn't too worried, but all these new guys panicked and ran towards a ditch. Well, there was a barbed wire fence along the edge of that ditch, and I got carried into it, and my utility trousers got ripped from the ankle all the way to my knee. Well, I didn't have time to change because the plane was coming in, so I got on board the plane with my trousers ripped, and didn't think too much about it. Got landed in Okinawa, got off the plane. I'm walking across the tarmac, and this captain, this little Bandy Rooster type captain, walked up to me and called me to attention. I'm a first lieutenant now, and I'm a pretty salty first lieutenant. I haven't survived a year of combat, and this guy with the spit-shine jungle boots, starched utility trousers and shirt, has me at attention, chewing me out for wearing torn trousers. And there was a moment there where I was ready to punch this guy out, and then I thought, you know what, I want to see my family again.
Sure.
So I just apologized and said, aye, sir, I'll take care of it and all this stuff, and left. But that was the first really experience that I had to make me wake up and realize I'm not in a combat zone now. Now I'm back in the world, the picky world of, you know, spit and polish. Then we went, a few nights later, we were at the officer club, and I ran into some guys that I'd served with in Vietnam and a couple of guys that I'd known since basic school, and so we got pretty snockered, and we were acting inappropriate. This major told us to step outside, and he chewed us out pretty good and said, "You guys aren't in Vietnam anymore. You're back in the world, and you've got to start acting like officers and gentlemen." So, okay, all right, that woke us up that we're now back in the real world. I got on my plane in Okinawa and headed towards the States, got off in Los Angeles International, and here I'm, you know, I'm down about 20 pounds from what I was when I went over there. My trousers are cinched up on me, and I sit down on one of those seats waiting to board my plane back to Tucson, and some girls walked by, and they were shouting, they were kind of making these comments about baby killer, and they were looking at my direction, and I'm looking around like, who are they talking to? Because I was in uniform, right? And they were flipping me off and talking about, you know, you blankety-blank baby killer. What is this? This was all new to me. No one had prepared me for anything like this. And so when they announced that I was to board, when I stood up, there was a hippie-type individual, you know, long hair and flowered shirt and stuff, sitting there with his guitar on a seat near him. And as I walked by, accidentally kicked his guitar, and it fell over. So he stood up and said something to me, and then deliberately stepped on my spit-shined low quarter shoe. Well, here again, the impulse inside me was to pick him up and toss him across the room. I had to just sit there and take it, because, you know, if I cause an incident like that, then I'd be charged with battery and I'd go to jail and da-da-da-da. I wanted to go home, so I just walked away, got on the plane, went home. But that was my first experience that all was not well here, and these people weren't blaming our government for what we're doing in Vietnam. They were blaming, they were blaming the warriors, and we were the ones that were taking the abuse. And I'm sure you heard the story many times, but that was my first experience with it. But I never again wore my uniform when I traveled, because I just, you know, I wasn't sure what I would do if somebody came up again and said something like that to me.
Sure. In many ways, of course, there's this transition period, trying to become acclimated while you're in country and combat and all of those incredibly intense period as you're learning, you're trying to get used to it. There's also, I think it's safe to say, a similar transition period, without, of course, the weapons and the life-threatening situations, but certainly a transition period from being in country, from being in combat, back to the world. Like you said, in Okinawa was your first experience with this, in that aspect of it, the spit and shine, spit and polish military, but then back to the United States. It is... And I don't know how it's something we could address, but it is certainly a difficulty in this, trying to put yourself in a position to be reacclimated into a society that is completely different from the environment that you just experienced intensely for the last year.
Yeah, very true. Fortunately, I was put back on a military base, and I tried living in bachelor officer quarters at Camp Lejeune. I kept running into this one lieutenant, first lieutenant, who had been shot. He'd been wounded, and the bullet had penetrated his torso, and he could hardly walk up the stairs. And the captain in the room next to me every surface in his room lined with empty Jim Beam bottles, and he was just a drunken sot. He was in that room. I'd hear him yelling and screaming sometimes. I didn't even want to talk to him. I didn't know what he had gone through. So I figured I had to get out of there, and I rented a small little house in Surf City, North Carolina, which was just down the beach from Camp Lejeune. And I had this little beach house just on the other side of a berm that I could hear the waves coming in at night, and I'd take long walks along the beach in the evening. Sometimes I'd get out in the morning about 5 o'clock, just as the sun was coming up, and I'd have the whole beach to myself. And that was really the best therapy for me, was being able to kind of just unwind. I'm really thankful that I had that beach house to go to, and that I could get away from the military for a while.
Sure.
Why did I get out of the Marine Corps? Okay. Because I had joined to make it a career. and I was pretty sure until I got to Camp Lejeune that I was going to stay in and make it a 20-year career. Do you have time for this?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. The first thing that happened, the first nail in the coffin, was having my whole company stand at attention in the rain one afternoon while we were told that we had to have a certain percentage of our men contribute to the Navy Relief Fund, which was for Marines that were having trouble making their rent payment or had fallen on some hard times and they needed to have some extra food, and maybe they couldn't pay their utility bill or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had Marines in my company who were E4s, married with a couple of kids, barely surviving on the pay that they were making. And they had to stand out there in the rain and agree that they would have part of their paycheck taken from them from the Navy Relief Fund. Okay, that was the first straw. That was the first nail in the coffin. Then the second nail in the coffin was they had this Operation Ever Ready, which meant that every Friday night, one battalion on the base, it could be from any unit, tanks, artillery, supply, infantry, they would get the word that they had to mount out. They had to get everybody loaded aboard trucks, get down to the rail site, and be ready to head out, theoretically, because something had happened over in Saudi Arabia or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So every Friday night, instead of our men being able to take off for liberty, to get away after working their tails off all week, now they had to hang around and wait to see if 3rd Tank Battalion was the one that got the, drew the short straw and had to mount out. And this went on every week for months. And then someone would call about 8 o'clock that night and say, okay, stand down, it's not your battalion. Well, so it's too late now for these guys to get out and head down to Myrtle Beach or go up to Washington, D.C. or wherever they needed to go. It was too late. So morale was so far down. And I'm the company commander, and I'm responsible for everything that happens with one of my men, one of my pieces of equipment. I mean, I'm the one that has to answer for everything. And I was feeling really, really bad about what some general or colonel up there was doing to enhance his career at the expense of everybody else there at Camp Lejeune. So that's the way I felt about it. So that was really the second nail in the coffin. And there was something else that happened. I guess it's the being responsible for things you have no control over. If I had a private down at the PX, and he's standing there with his flak jacket open, his field jacket open, and some senior officer walks by and he doesn't salute, well, that officer's going to find out what the man's name is and what unit he's with. They're going to report to my battalion commander that Private Smith failed to salute a colonel at the PX, and then I'll be called down to the colonel's office, and I'll be standing there at attention getting chewed out because of something Private Smith did the day before. It takes a special kind of person to be able to put up with that kind of stuff, and I just decided that wasn't me. I can't live with being responsible for things that I don't have any control over.
Sure.
Theoretically, the captain goes down with the ship, and everyone in your chain of command, you're at the top, so if they mess up or anything happens to them, you're ultimately responsible. That was a hard one, and I didn't realize that when I was thinking about making the Marines a career. I think it's the same way in the Army, Air Force, Navy. It's just mentally and emotionally, I couldn't see myself doing 20 years with that sort of stuff because it doesn't stop. I mean, if you promote up the line, you go to captain to major, you're going to experience the same thing. You go from major to colonel, it's the same thing, just higher up people chewing you out.
Well, when did you get out then?
I got out in 1970, early 1970.
What did you do from there?
I went back to graduate school at San Diego State, got a master's degree in public administration, and planned to have a city government career. Worked in city government in Tucson as an assistant city manager. Hated it. didn't like being cooped up in a room with a calculator and a stack full of tax records and public documents. I needed to have some human contact, some interaction, and feel like I was, you know, solving problems with people and things. So I went back to the University of Arizona Career Guidance Department and said, I don't think I know what I want to be when I grow up. And he sat me down and gave me a whole battery of inventories, aptitudes, interest tests, and things. And it came up all over the place, loud and clear, that I needed to be in a helping profession. Administrative stuff was, I was okay, but that wasn't going to make me feel self-actualized. So I still had the GI Bill. Anyway, I went out to the Arizona Youth Center in Tucson, and I volunteered with those boys that were incarcerated as a counselor, and I loved it. I mean, I said, this is what I want to do. So they hired me, didn't do a background check or anything, just hired me as a youth supervisor, and that's what I did for the next year and a half, 2 years. Is I quit my job with the city, took a cut in pay, went out to the Arizona Youth Center, and loved every day of work. I just couldn't wait. Usually Sunday nights I would think, oh, geez, I have to go to work tomorrow. But in this job, it was, yay, I get to go to work tomorrow.
That's terrific.
So I knew I'd found my niche, and then I went back to graduate school again to get a master's in social work at Arizona State. And my thinking was that I would not only know how to work with delinquent kids and do some treatment with them, but I would probably be real promotable with two master's degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. I completed that master's in social work in 1974, got on with the California Youth Authority as a parole agent, and spent the next 30 years working with the California Youth Authority, and worked my, at one point I was a superintendent of an institution, and that's what I was doing when I retired.
And when did you retire?
So then when I retired, I started thinking, well, now I've got some time on my hands. How about getting to work on that book that I've been thinking about all those years? And so I did. In 2000, I started working on it. And in 2004, I was told, I'd encountered quite a few rejections, and I was thinking maybe this was never going to fly. But there's a historian that, I'm blanking on his name right now. But anyway, I talked to him, and he said, you know, you ought to try the university presses. Your book is historical and of interest, probably in the military history crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Go to some of the university presses. So I went, contacted the University of Alabama Press, and it so happened that the senior editor was a Vietnam veteran. And he called me as soon as he got my manuscript and said, Jim, this is exactly what we're looking for. So after I got done jumping up and down and, you know, hollering and hooting and celebrating, you know, we got down to business. Anyway, I got the book published in 2004, Kantian, The Hill of Angels.
That's terrific.
And it's not about me. It's about Kantian and all the stuff I could dig up on is how, why, when, and where this all happened. And part of my motivation was that I was pretty worried that everything that we had done at Kantian would just get buried and it wouldn't come to light, that Quezon and other places would, when they thought about Vietnam and the Vietnam War, they would go to Quezon and Tet, and that's what would be covered. And I wanted to try to ensure that, you know, hey, what about what we did at Kantian?
Well, I've read your book, and like I said yesterday, I found it to be a very well-done work.
Thank you. It's in a second printing now. The first printing sold out, and the second printing came out in paperback. And I understand it's doing pretty well, too. So.
Well, terrific.
I've
got one more question to ask you, Mr. Cohn, and it is this. Looking back on your experiences relative to the Vietnam War. What is it that stands out the most clearly to you? What I think the question I want to ask you is, what did you learn about yourself personally the most from your experiences in Vietnam?
About myself, well, I think I'd always heard it said that bravery is the ability to function in spite of your fear, and so I can relate to that. That despite being scared out of my wits sometimes, I managed to hold it together okay and still do what I had to do and be effective. So I think that was one of the main things I learned about myself, mm-hmm. was that, yeah, you get butterflies, you get terrified, you get scared, but I wasn't the type that was just going to lay down in a hole and get in a fetal position. So about myself, I'd say that was probably the main thing I came away with, that I could handle it, mm-hmm. that I passed the test. I think the, was there anything else? I'm sure, you know, when we hang up the phone, I'll think about some other things. that was the most important thing, was that I learned that in the face of fear, I wouldn't freeze up, that I would take action and keep moving and do what I had to do.
Well, is there anything else?
I came away with a tremendous sense of pride, though, in the young Marines, because, you know, I was 25 years old, and those were kids barely out of high school, you know, 19-year-old. I remembered when I was 18, 19 years old, that this whole idea of, you know, danger and getting wounded and killed and all that stuff was a lot. I don't know, I was philosophically much more ready to be in combat at 25 than I was at 18 or 19.
Sure.
So I just had this highest respect and admiration for those Marines that I served with, and I'll never forget that.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we put that into
this?
No,
I think it's fantastic that Texas Tech University has this Vietnam War archive, and that what happened there will be there hopefully forever, and as long as there's a Texas Tech University. I'm just really, really pleased that there is a place in the country where all of this stuff is recorded for posterity, and any researchers that want to go there to find out what happened and all that. It's just I'm very happy that you guys exist.
Well, thank you very much. We're very pleased with the work we're doing here, and very, very proud that we were able to do it.
Okay.
Well, this will put an end to the interview with Mr. Jim Cone.